Severin Films will be at Monsterpalooza this weekend with hot-off-the-press copies of Sergio Stilvoletti's Wax Mask, produced by Dario Argento, from a story by Lucio Fulci. Special two-disc limited edition slipcase and limited slip edition of Killer Crocodile with bonus Blu-ray disc Killer Crocodile 2. Come by and see us at the Monsterpalooza with all the Severin and Intervision discs on hand, including the last few copies of our out-of-print web exclusive The Vi and Combat Shock. Next week, keep your eye on the Severin Films socials and website for our Halloween release titles, three Italian productions that have never been on Blu-ray or DVD before in America. There'll be Vampires, Possession, and Incest. So stay tuned for the Halloween Severin announcements next week on the Severin Films social media platforms and at www.severin-films.com.
Tonight's episode of Shockwaves is also brought to you by Vinegar Syndrome. Vinegar Syndrome is back with a vengeance, presenting an all-horror lineup this September. From James Hong, co-star of The Big Trouble in Little China, comes The Vineyard, a wild 80s zombie classic that's long overdue for a Blu-ray release. Then, one of the craziest horror comedies you've never seen, Paul Ziller's never-officially-on-disc rarity Pledge Night, which evenly balances its frat house set, TNA-filled hijinks with impressive gore and creature effects. Plus, one from Herb Fried, director of Graduation Day, comes Beyond Evil, a stylish supernatural horror film starring Linda Day, George, and John Saxton. Saving the best and rarest for last, Ignacio Inquino's barely-released Spanish shocker, Secta Sinestra, gets its U.S. debut in any format. This hybrid of Rosemary's Baby and The Exorcist is a non-stop assault on good taste and deserves to be listed among the ranks of the trashiest films from Joe D'Amato and Bruno Mattei. Be sure to visit vinegarsyndrome.com for plenty of other exploitation classics and buried treasures, along with exclusive deals, sales, and limited editions. And make sure to check out the site this Friday the 13th for the unveiling of VS's mouthwatering October announcements, which include a never-on-disc slasher, more Euro horror, and their very first horror box set. Also be sure to say hello to the Vinegar Syndrome team at the Son of Monsterpalooza in Los Angeles, MondoCon in Austin, Requiem Fear Fest in Montreal, Fantastic Fest in Austin, Lund International Fantastic Film Festival in Lund, Sweden, and as always, Cinema Wasteland in Cleveland.
Okay, welcome to episode 159 of Shockwaves. I'm one of your hosts, Rob Galluzzo, sitting here with Elric Kane.
What's up? Back. The whole team, except for one.
Well, except for one.
Rebecca McKendry's here.
Hi, guys.
No Ryan Turek. Turek is shooting, I think, almost.
He's on pre-pro.
Yeah,
it looks like. He's about to start.
Yeah, yeah, Halloween. They're starting soon.
I mean, it's not really fall yet.
It is.
It's still hot.
He's been posting up pictures if it's
called
90.
Movies, Elric. Suspension of disbelief.
It's all being shot in a big warehouse in Burbank.
The world is day for night, Elric. That's all there is.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. But we wish him well, and we wish he was here. Whole lot going on. If you're traveling with us, we're going to Salem Horror Fest.
Yep.
Right, which is at the beginning of October. I believe it kicks off, I want to say October 4th all the way through the 17th or so. We're going to be there October 11th for Tales from the Crypt panel, and we'll be doing a live episode talking about our favorite episodes with John Cassier, the Crypt Keeper himself.
Nice.
I've got two in my head that I consider my favorites so far.
I've got to go back and revisit a couple before I send over my definitive list.
It's the only bummer is I kind of want to watch all of them again.
I know we don't have time.
Yeah, guys, we don't have time for that.
Even though we had warning a year out, I could have been
because I wanted to do the same thing and was then suddenly like, well, this is going to take a while. So I started looking at like best of lists from other journalists.
And when I do that, I often see the ones I remember best, but it's also like, I'd like to see a couple I don't remember.
Well, there's a couple that I remember loving that don't make any of the lists. Like I remember a tattoo one where whatever you tattoo on your skin kind of
bursts out of
the
skin.
Oh, yeah, that was the rock star one. Yeah. Where, I think like Tia Carrera was in
Tia
that.
Carrera was
in
it, yeah.
Just skim the synopsis and cast, and you'll almost immediately be like, oh, yeah, I remember.
Oh, yeah, no, one. It's, yeah. It's like it is a total trigger to your memory. It's kind of great. But yeah. I am excited about that, and to do it with John Kassir is really cool. And also mostly excited just because, A, I've been hearing about this festival for actually a long time, and to be in Salem in this season. I went once as a
gosh.
Kid driving through at not that season, and it stuck with me for my whole life, like remembering that, wow, this is the town where the stuff actually went down.
This is going to be the most LA thing I'm ever going to say. Actually, there's probably more things, but I'm going to buy a coat because I don't own a coat.
I have coats. Yeah, all right. We're good.
I don't know if I kept them. I used to have them
in Chicago. See, that's it. I'm like, that's when weird. I moved from New York,
I have a trench coat.
I kept them for like a year, and then I was like, I don't own a coat anymore. I have like a lightweight jean jacket, so I'm going to buy a coat for
that's
Salem.
Cool. That is exciting.
I'm going a couple days earlier than you guys because I can't be there as long at the back end because I have another festival to go down to, a different related to something else, but I'm getting there purposely so as I could go to the John Waters thing.
Ooh. That thing looked good.
I know. It's just as soon as I saw that, I was like, I need to go see John Waters.
I know. Life, I wish I can't get out of too many classes and I would have to miss extras to go to that. So I had to pick and choose because the next weekend I'm going to miss more stuff because right after that we are headed to Knoxville.
Knoxville is a festival.
Knoxville Horror Film Fest.
I've been helping involved in the judging of the shorts for the last few years.
For the past, 4 years.
But last year was the first year I could go to it, and I'm so glad I did. I had such a good time. William Mahaffey runs and Central Cinema runs such a cool fest. They have like seats with armrests. There's a Shockwaves armrest that is on one of them. It's just like I really dug it, and the lineup this year is great. It's like a lot of the same stuff playing at Beyond Fest. So you know, if you live in that anywhere in that region, you could drive down there. And there was a lot of people. A lot of Shockwaves people. It was like me and Jill Gervaisigan and Brian Lonano from Gwilliam. Who's the stylist?
Yeah, we love you, Jill.
There you go. There was somebody else, but we did our show on. What did we do? We did our last year. I did the top five. I think it was like the five horror films that made them.
Yeah.
It's kind of like that thing. And it was fun. It would have been more fun with you guys too, but.
Hey, well, we might be able to do that this year.
This year we have that and trivia and we'll do a whole bunch of stuff.
I am so excited because we actually get to like go all up fall for this year. Cause I mean, we don't have fall like I remember it from my childhood.
That's true in LA.
Cause it's 90 degrees and leaves don't really fall.
Yeah. And except in Pasadena, if you have Dean Cundey in a little bag of leaves.
So I'm pretty excited to actually like go smell fall, which is a weird thing to say, but fall has a smell and we don't get that here.
Yeah,
and that's going to be October 17th through the 20th. So,
and I think we're there, the whole time pretty much for this one. Yeah. So that's cool. That's rare. And it's chill. The pacing of that one's a little more chill, which is cool because there's it can be a little, I don't know about you, but, I do know about Rob. I know Rob doesn't like a non-chill fest.
I've seen Rob at Comic-Con before. Rob likes chill.
Can I just tell you something? I was having an anxiety attack just watching all of you trying to get tickets for Beyond Fest on Twitter. Oh, yeah. I was like, you know what? I don't even want to go because just watching you argue about tickets.
Yeah.
And it's like,
Color Out of Space.
Oh my
Thank
God.
Thank you, Elric. Got
Great.
Mine.
It'll be out in a few months. Yeah. I'm sure.
Well, yeah, no, I get it. But it's like the festivals where there's like five things happening at once. And if you go to this, you're now sacrificing that. That bums me out at times.
Me too,
you know? And it makes it a little stressful. And
no, that always makes me sad at like Chattanooga because there's always like three films playing at the same time that I want to see. And
the worst is when that's happening in a really good thing is playing and no one's in there because they're all at something else.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, but this thing's...
Anyway. No one's missing Girdlerthon.
That's what we need to mention. So this is something even before Shaka Khan, was created in my bad joke. Girdlerthon is something we actually talked about and really wanted to do. But I mean, obviously, I'd love to do all his films and actually it would be cool to travel to like where he's from because he's from Kentucky, I believe. But this is pretty close. So we're going to...
You've got Grizzly,
we got three movies.
The Manitou, and then a question mark for the last movie.
Oh, okay. I see why that is. Okay.
Ooh.
There wasn't a question mark there before, but it's probably for reasons that are obvious to anyone who follows anything.
Oh, Rick.
All I'll say, I won't say anything. But the one I'm most excited about, because I haven't seen it in like forever, and I actually requested this one because he was going in a different direction, is Grizzly. Like, I've only seen Grizzly once. It was years and years ago.
Good.
No, it's, and I remember, and but it's like, I want to see that in a room full of people all going batshit every time the Big Bear comes out.
Yeah,
that'll
be fun.
Have you seen Grizzly
2? I've seen bits of it, with all the weird missing shots of the bear. And
well, the bear isn't working.
They didn't finish it. But
supposedly, they ran out of money and pulled the mechanics out of it and walked away. way.
George Clooney was in there?
George Clooney, Helen Hunt's in it. Yeah. You can find it on YouTube if you look hard enough.
But yeah, looking into Girdler, you know, what's interesting is, you know, I posted about, but it's like, you know, dude made 9 movies and then died at 30, under 30,
oh my God.
Which means he did it all in a couple years' time. Like between the age of 25 and like 29, he made like these, it's pretty wild. And they're getting pretty, and like Manitou's actually an ambitious movie. The next movie would have been this big sci-fi epic that he was location scouting. He crashed, you know? So it's, I think that kind of spirit deserves to be celebrated.
Yeah.
Especially with exploitation horror. Let's do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Girdler thong. And we are going to be making a Girdler thong. So if you wear the Girdler thong and nothing else, you'll probably get him free. William Mahaffey, back me up. Nothing official there.
William Mahaffey's cringing right now.
Wow.
Cringing.
But I have committed him to this now by saying it aloud.
No one's going to want to sit in those seats again.
I'll be wearing
I don't want anybody to show up in a Girdler thong. That's ridiculous.
Well, I will.
Ulrich will committed. Be in a Girdler thong.
So instead of touching my face, we're going to touch. No, okay. Moving on.
Wow. Oh, man.
So what else do you guys have planned for Halloween? I mean, a couple of Beyond Fest
I can't think
Beyond.
That far. I can't think that far.
My brain cannot go past those festivals and Beyond Fest, my brain's like, oh my God, hopefully very little after
Are
that.
You guys doing Monsterpalooza this weekend? Because I'm thinking, I'm going on Sunday.
I'll be there tonight when this episode airs, Friday night. So yeah, that'll be fun. Did any of you make it out to the Evil Dead exhibit this weekend?
No, I wanted to go on Friday night when it was open.
Saturday night.
No, I wanted to go Friday night, and that's why I'm mad. To be honest, it wasn't even open.
It wasn't open yet. Yeah.
I just got like very lazy at the last minute, but I really do still want to go.
It was pretty great. It was probably the Mystic Museum's biggest show ever.
Wow.
I mean, the lines, there was like a line 4 blocks long.
That's why I drove past.
You would have been on the list, I'm sure.
I mean, I picked up a pizza about 2 hours before it opened and there were already people lining up. And I was like, I don't know if I can do this tonight.
Crowds are tough, but it's now open so you can go during the day and check it out. And it's pretty cool. I mean, Jose, who's on last week, who works for Ghost House Pictures, kind of gave us the background of how basically he was just cleaning out Rob Tappert's garage and finding these props. But it really is impressive to see them all together. And I mean, it's everything from an original unused script for Evil Dead 3 to his metal hand from Army of Darkness to the chainsaw from, Evil Dead 2. And Jose's like, that's my chainsaw. And I'm like, oh, it's yours? And he's like, yes.
Oh,
There's some cool – the different versions of the Necronomicon. I mean, even Bruce Campbell's whatever, that blue shirt. That's like hanging up everywhere. And the coolest thing really was they have a photo op where you recreate the poster to Evil Dead.
I saw some of those online.
It's pretty amazing. Yeah. Basically, you just get in the position of the girl that's on that infamous poster coming out of the ground and you do that. But it's really cool. They've recreated some of the basement set. And, you know, it's just, if you're an Evil Dead fan, I think you have to try to see it this season. So
cool.
I enjoyed it immensely.
Nice.
That's great.
Yeah.
What else did you do, Rob? See any movies?
I saw a few. I have not made it to It.
What?
Yet.
Oh, yeah.
Was it because you went to Evil Dead?
I went to Evil Dead that Saturday. Honestly, every time time I tried to go see it the time defeated me.
It's a 3-hour commitment.
That's
it
why.
Is.
So every
it's
time I was
commitment.
About to see it was either like packed, and then another night I tried to go, and I was like, I could get so much more work done if I just.
All right, we'll do a quick non-spoiler.
Okay, fair enough. I tried. I'm going to probably end up seeing it tomorrow.
Right, it's worth it. Even though that it was 3 hours long, it didn't feel 3 hours. Like Suspiria, halfway through, I was like, ugh, how long is this going on? And I felt the same way through Midsommar. I did not notice the length in it, too.
I saw so many people in our social group being negative about it right after it came out that my expectations dropped dramatically suddenly because I was like, oh, okay. Suddenly it's not the mass breed and everyone's complaining about length and stuff. And then I was so pleasantly surprised by it, but it's so different. It's the comedy is what I walk away going, that was really funny and fun and like big chillish. I don't think it's as good, definitely not as good a horror film. Like the scares to me don't, besides there's one sequence that I think is like one of the best of the year, like the stuff that's in the trailer with Jessica Chastain, the old woman, that as a sequence is much longer in the movie. And
the tension is great.
It's like David Lynch sequence. Like it's really good. But the horror stuff, you know, it grows into becoming a blockbuster by the end. But man, Bill Hader in this movie is beyond MVP. It's such role. He's so funny. Him and James Ransom are both hilarious in this movie.
The character of Richie across the board is just ridiculous. ridiculous, and it's phenomenal.
Yeah, no, but I really liked it. Like, I genuinely had a really good time, and like I think they like I what I guess I don't fully understand is somebody who loved the first one and hates the second one. I'm like, because to me they're kind of the same piece.
Yeah.
Like,
well, kind of. I get parts of that because the first one is terrifying scare after scare. Yeah. I mean, you've got like the slideshow, you've got all headless Easter egg kit, you've got all of these like really just intensely scary moments all built in. This is almost making fun of what they went through. I mean, there's a point where Richie even kind of mocks the dance that Pennywise did. Like, it makes fun of it because it seems like something from their childhood. And then that said, this movie is not as scary as the first one.
No,
I think it's great because it's kind of, yeah, it is. The Big Chill is a horror film.
Well, and like people comparing it to Nightmare on Elm Street, the sequels are nailing it because Freddy also couldn't stay scary.
Yeah.
So Pennywise was a, you know, pop icon in like what? A day? Like as soon as it came out, he was already an icon.
Yeah.
This new version of him. And so it's like a year and a bit later. Yeah. It's hard to maintain that scariness, even though it's nothing they're doing. It's just how we interpret it.
But they seem it. I think that's, it's very self-aware within the film because they seem to almost be making fun of their childhood fear. Like, yeah, remember when we were all scared of that clown, right? And, you know, kind of like you would be, you know, making fun of being scared of the closet monster or something like that.
Yeah.
And then slowly they get resubmerged in it. I thought the Chinese restaurant scene was wonderful.
Yeah, that's early on.
So well, look, I haven't seen it yet. I'm looking forward to it. I just need to carve out 3 hours. But the thing is this. I mean, and this is the same with the original 1990. It's the same with the book. The adult story is just not as strong as the kid story. It never was.
Yeah.
And I also find it shockingly mysterious that they didn't shoot these back to back. They like shot the first one, waited to see how it did. And then this one, you can answer for me. I thought it was all the adults, but they do a bunch of the kids stuff.
There's some kids flashbacks.
Yeah, I think there's quite a lot.
And the amount of money.
It's new material.
Well, and they had to de-age everybody and hire voice actors because the kids grew up so much in the last 2 years.
Wow, they actually look. It looks like they could have just shot it back to back with the first.
They did not. This is superhero movie budget.
You don't even notice the de-aging. Like,
no,
I would not have noticed that.
But I heard that, and I heard they had to, like, cast, like, kid voices because their voices even changed so much.
Weird.
So, I don't know. I know that's going to bug me when I see it, but I'm like, wait, well, I thought it was the first one was kids.
I truly didn't notice any of that.
I didn't notice any of it.
Okay. You know, it really does feel like a pair. And it's genuinely funny, not, like, accidentally funny. Like, Bill Hader. The most impressive thing is the cast. That cast of adult-like actors is fantastic.
Costume. And it's weird for me to walk away from a film and say costuming, but the one that everyone has pointed out is that Richie's shirt is the same as the shirt from Friday the 3rd, or from Nightmare on Elm 2, which is really smart, but it does not stop there. Like, across the board, like, costuming for me was a big thing in this one.
No, yeah, it's good. But yeah, I mean, I think it's always hard to beat young people because there's a lot more romance to the young person storyline, and that's not present in this. You know, there's some light romance plus, but nothing you feel. You're not feeling that element in this movie. But I had a good time. I definitely had more fun than when we saw Scary Stories. Like there are some similarities, actually, you know, going off with characters and, you know, this kind of sprawling thing. But this was just, to me, it was a good, fun film.
Yeah.
There's only a couple sequences I'd call scary. But I don't know if it didn't almost feel like their intention. It felt like they were making something else, you know?
Interesting.
Yeah. So I think you'll have fun. You might have other reasons to hate it, you know, like in terms of book to film comparisons that I'm not bringing in because I can't remember half that, you know?
Yeah.
So long.
Well, again, it's like that was what the first one was hinging on for me is like, I don't know. The whole adaption isn't done yet.
Yeah.
You know, so it'll affect the way I view the first one too.
I will say that when it ended, I remember the first thought I had was, oh, if they ever do Nightmare on Elm Street, I do think he's probably the right guy to bring it to try to make it scary, but also make a big movie out of it. Everyone else I like would be like little weird indie versions of it, but I do think he has that scale to probably pull that character off.
To make it a blockbuster.
Yeah, if they ever come up with a way that it could be done, you know?
Yeah.
But they don't need to. I'm in no rush to see that done. So yes, better than I expected, but also expectations had been lowered. So, you know, I don't know what that means.
All right.
Who else? What you got?
Does nobody have other movies?
I got a ton. Right,
that was the most tense the show has ever been.
I have two or three.
I thought you were going to shoot someone
dead. I watched Ma. which I don't know why I hadn't watched yet. It was one of these things when I got a copy in the mail, I was suddenly like, wait, why didn't I watch this yet? And I couldn't remember why I hadn't gone to see it in the theater.
I would watch it if I got a copy in the mail, but since I didn't, I'll watch it eventually.
I think Universal sent me one, but yeah, it was a blast, and I was not expecting to like it as much as I did, but it's like a Lifetime film after a couple of rails of Adderall. It's just, it's completely elevated, not elevated like smart-wise, like elevated like I can't believe they're fucking doing this, bonkers. And it's just about this woman who happens to be going into a liquor store right as these teenagers are trying to buy liquor, and they're outside trying to convince somebody to, you know, go inside and buy them beer. And she ends up agreeing to, and then she makes a couple connections that you get. It's like a Lifetime film in that they tell you everything that's going on from the start. She makes a couple connections with a couple of the kids, and that she knows their parents, and then she invites them back to, you know, drink in their basement, drink in her basement. And then throughout the rest of the movie is these kids are now using this place as their party pad, and she's becoming more kind of involved in their lives. You find out that she's not as balanced and that she has a history with all of their parents. And so, much like, you know, kind of a good Lifetime sleazy thriller, it really does show you all of its cards within the first 20 minutes, but then it just keeps getting more and more bonkers. And it was a blast. I had a great time with it.
I probably will do it. It was on an app. I watched the first 5 minutes of it, and I was just like, as soon as these teenagers are going into her basement, I was just watching. I just don't know if I can do it. Like,
oh, no.
I was just, I know it's going to get, she's going to get great and stuff, but there's just something about
amazing.
The setup that I was like, oh, that kind of a movie, you know?
Yeah. And I think that had I watched this in a different mood, I may not have appreciated it as much as I did, but I watched it, you know, kind of up for something silly and fun. And so that's how I approached it. And it is, it's just fucking bonkers.
And she is such a good actress that I'm sure it will win me over. So I will definitely promise to watch the whole movie.
Yeah. It was fun.
Well, I saw Becca's favorite movie of the year.
Oh, God.
Jim Jarmusch's The Dead Don't Die.
Ooh.
Okay.
Friend of the show, Brian, enjoyed it the other night. And then I saw, and I could watch his copy, and Becca raved about it.
Oh, my God.
She said it was, I think she told me what she said. It's like having a colonoscopy, a horror colonoscopy, or was it a horror root canal?
Horror root canal.
That was your exact quote. I guess that's not a good review.
somebody posted
Why didn't you start this? Well, my
bone to pick, because what you guys talked about this while I was away.
No.
We've never seen this before.
Never seen it.
Ryan
has seen it when it was in theaters, and he liked it.
Gave it like a meh review.
You guys accused it of trying to be a Zombieland ripoff, or why are they doing it?
Yeah, it does look like that.
It's not. Jim Jarmusch could never make a Zombieland ripoff. He would make a Jim Jarmusch, because I watched what's the vampire one?
Right, but that film's
great.
Wildly original.
Love that
but
film.
But that's Jarmusch.
That's what you're hoping for.
That's what you hope going in, is that you're going to get a Jarmusch film with zombies. This, and I like Jarmusch. I mean, Jarmusch was my college years. He's part of the reason I am here, was because I was found so much connections with Jarmusch's work. And I loved his Vampire One. This one I found to be incredibly taxing. You know, it begins like any other Jarmusch film, where it's weird, quirky characters that seemingly have no point kind of going through their day-to-day lives. And they just keep getting quirkier and quirkier. And it's the normal, like, slate of Jarmusch actors, where we've got Iggy Pop and Tom Waits, which was kind of one
Bill Murray.
Yeah, Bill Murray. Tom Waits was my favorite part of the movie, because he plays like a crazy, like, homeless man in the woods watching everything. But then zombies happen, and it's a very Plan 9 from Outer Space way that they happen. And the movie becomes so winking at the audience, not even winking. It's just like, so you like Romero films, and then continue with a 2-minute conversation about Romero films before they continue on. That's what taxed me more than anything.
I mean, this film hasn't obviously been, you know, this is, it seems overall has been disappointing people, I'd say, in the bulk. Yeah, my experience isn't far off, because only difference, and you might not even be different, is the first 25 minutes, I was literally going, oh, it's just like old Jarmusch movies. It's almost could have been like a 3.5 star for me at that point, where I was like, oh, it's going to just be a Jarmusch movie, and Bill Murray, and it's kind of like the slow
Buscemi's
pace.
Buscemi's a character.
And it's funny, and I was really getting into it, but man, like really, once the zombies come, it feels, you really have seen all of this before.
There's nothing.
And it feels like he really is a few years late, and that it's almost like he didn't know of any of the other things. It's almost like he saw the Romero films and thought this would be great, but didn't know that all the other movies that and Walking Dead existed
between now and then. Because he references Romero so much and talks about a lot of other zombie horrors. And that's what it feels like, is if Jarmusch just kind of picked up right after Dawn of the Dead and decided, you know, it would be fun if I made a parody of this. And decades missing.
And there's some pretty idiosyncratic stuff still in it. Like Tilda Swinton is totally bizarro. Like, I don't even, she's like in a different movie.
I don't even know what was going on there. That's where
it's pretty out there. There's
he was
pretty
pushing
out there
it pretty, like, I'm fine if Steve Buscemi is kind of the weird racist truck driver, but then Tilda Swinton shows up as the Irish mortician samurai.
Scottish.
And it's just kind of like, you're just putting shit together right now, aren't you?
But one person is stellar. And I
looked at the cast list. Tell me it's Larry Fessenden.
Larry Fessenden
is amazing.
The whole movie. You know, he's like not a bad guy, but he's like loves his cats and stuff. And so it's just fun. All the animals are kind of hiding or whatever. Mm-hmm. But it's always fun to see Larry in a bigger movie and to see him in a Jarmusch movie and that kind of pacing. It's good. His comic timing's great. And I don't know. It's definitely a disappointment, though. I can't lie. Like, compared to the Vampire, it's not even in the same ballpark.
The Vampires I found to be charming.
Lovers Left Alive.
Yeah, Last Lovers Left Alive. There was a sexiness to the movie. It had some style to it. I felt like I had not seen that plot before presented in that way. This just didn't do it for me.
Also, it's hard because Bill Murray's in, you know, the one we were just talking about, Zombieland.
Oh, yeah.
And so it's hard not to see a comparison because you're like, oh, the tones are actually, his isn't fast moving, but the tones are similar.
They're
like,
very similar.
And one is really entertaining. And then, you know, so it's, I don't know. It's definitely, it feels like a misfire, but like some people dig it. So I think that's cool. You know, I just don't know if it was the right time.
Yeah, it was not the movie for me.
I did see some stills. Somebody had changed. Because the first couple zombie images of people coming out are really atmospheric. And actually, the first couple times you see it, you're like, oh, wow, that could have been in a different movie. And somebody had flipped it to black and white and said, this movie actually plays a lot better as like an old feeling Romero. And I'm like, oh, that's interesting. I don't know if that would be true because the comedy I don't think would suit the black and white. But some maybe the images of zombies. Yeah. So.
Wow. All right.
There you go.
Dead Don't Die.
Yeah, Dead Don't Die.
All right. Well, I got a Vinegar Syndrome title that I thought I saw this movie, but I definitely did not. And it's called Hell Comes to Frogtown.
I love this movie. Yeah.
I recommended this on a Pure Cinema episode of Kitty Midnights.
Wow.
Yeah. This is a movie I enjoy.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, Roddy Piper, God rest his soul, he delivered one of the great performances in They Live. And I didn't really see him in too many other movies other than like bit parts or kind of like,
Not as a lead.
This was the only other one I remember from loosely around that time period. Vinegar Syndrome just did an excellent restoration of it. I don't know how a modern audience will respond to this, but it takes place in a post-apocalyptic world where the gal from the original Conan the Barbarian, Chandel Bergman, who is, you know, the – I forgot her character's name, but basically she's the main girl in Conan. So I guess it's her mission to repopulate the world. There's mutated beings running around, and yet they want Roddy Piper because he – is a man's man, and his job is to repopulate fertile women.
Yeah, because there aren't many males who are fertile anymore, I think is the problem.
Yes.
In this post-apocalypse. Yeah.
So, yeah, it's just like they're just like lugging him around, like, well, you got to get out there and find fertile women. And it's like, wow.
Been there.
Society depends on you, Piper.
Yeah.
Pretty much. And so it's pretty fun. It's funny. It kind of reminds me of like, it'd be like, it's in the world of like that crazy cantina from Star Wars. Like if that was all that was left of the world was like those crazy creatures and then, well, and they're frog people, whatever.
Yeah. The actual creatures are really bizarre.
Yeah. They're fun. I mean,
they're done well. It doesn't feel cheap. That's the thing. It feels like they actually put the resources behind it. And it's a weird tone too, because it's sometimes kind of serious and sometimes really goofy.
Yeah, it leans way more into the goofy, I think, more than anything. Like, it's definitely a fun, like
Saturday night sort of like cult movie or whatever. Yeah. What did you pair it with when you did the?
Yeah, no. You, so now that you say it out loud, I don't fucking remember. It's like, what was I thinking? But no, it was one. Oh, I do know. Frog Dreaming, the Australian one with you know, the it's called The Dreaming, or I think Frog Dreaming. It's E.T. Elliot from E.T. It was a big film of my childhood because it was Australian. But Brian Chenchard Smith made it. But it's a really good kids movie. And it's about this kid who lives near this giant pit filled with water, and he thinks there's a monster in it.
It was released as The Quest here in America.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah,
interesting.
It's frog a really dreaming. Fun movie, but because Frog Dreaming and the frogs, it's a no-brainer.
Your frog theme, yeah.
It's a no-brainer.
Yeah, all right. Well, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So, no, I liked it. And again, as usual, you know, Vinegar Syndrome Rose does a great job with this. There's tons of great special features and all that jazz. It's a pretty lengthy interview with Roddy that, you know, obviously he passed away a couple years ago. So maybe from the previous DVD release or something. I'm not sure. But yeah, no, it's this is fun, crazy, almost like a post-Corman feeling sort of apocalyptic.
Yeah, it also almost feels like it fits in the world of things like Trancers and stuff as well.
Maybe like a full
Cherry moon. Cherry 2000. Yeah. There's a whole, those kind of fun post-apocalyptic movies.
That would be a hell of a marathon for a weekend.
Oh, yeah. All those kind of things. Yeah. That'd be a good time.
Hell Comes to Frogtown.
All right. What about you, Becca? Anything more?
So I happened upon a couple of years ago, I was at a flea market and somebody had a whole bunch of international horror DVDs, and I picked up one for a film called Hemoglobin.
I saw your cover of that. I didn't know that movie, though.
So I brought it home, started watching it, and then I realized I was watching Bleeders. And you will recognize that one because that is the squishy VHS box cover.
Oh, yeah.
So I realized once I'd started watching it that that's what I was watching, and it was just retitled Hemoglobin for whatever region I had gotten it from. But then I was in, so I was like, okay, well, I guess I'm watching Bleeders tonight. So I rewatched the whole thing. This one, Bleeders came out in 1997, and I'd say what it is best known for is that squishy VHS box cover. The movie, I mean, it's got some fun moments to it. It is what I'm always shocked by is it's written by Dan O'Banion and Robert Shusett, who did the Alien movies. And so we've got some really competent writers behind it. And the creature effects towards the end, you know, some of the shots, they definitely needed to be a little bit darker. Maybe it was just watching it on a nice DVD copy. But they were done by, the creature effects were done by Adrian Moreau, who is just a legend in kind of the effects world, did Martyrs and just did the alligator work and Crawl and things like that. So he's been rocking for a long time, but he did the creatures in this. The whole thing is about this guy who has this really weird blood disease. And goes into convulsions and bleeds out of his eyeballs and stuff like that and is basically dying. And his girlfriend slash nurse decides to take him to this weird, desolate island where he's from so they can see if they can find out if his family had this weird blood disease. And then it's based off The Lurking Fear, the H.P. Lovecraft story. So there's a lot of like weird incesty stuff and mutants and totally fun on an island. So, yeah.
Is it good?
If you're, I'll put it in kind of like the same way I rank Vinegar Syndrome, where it's kind of like I'm really glad I watched it. I can always kind of, you know, get something out of it that I'm like, hey, that was a good scene. As a whole, you're kind of watching the first hour and 10 minutes just to get to the cool creatures.
Okay.
Yeah. And they come up like in the last 20. So, yeah. But that said, H.P. Lovecraft fans, you will like it.
All right.
I got a couple more really quickie ones. I just wanted to mention that Kino Lorber had put out several months ago a new version of Hannibal, the Ridley Scott Hannibal.
Oh, nice.
What kind of difference?
A 4K version.
So there's 4K. No cuts, though. Yeah.
No, it's not like a different version of the movie. It's just a 4K restoration of it. And then I got the Blu-ray, which because the previous one excluded all the bonus features, which I believe were all done by Charles Lazarica, who does all the Ridley Scott stuff. Yeah. And I mean, it's, you know, it's pretty extensive stuff. But I picked that up. I haven't seen the movie in years. I haven't seen it since the show.
Since I started doing impersonations for you.
Well, I mean, I always know that impersonation. You can never forget it, which is Gary Oldman as Mason Verger.
Seemed like a good idea.
But,
at the time. still probably one of the greatest lines in the history of movies.
It is pretty great. This movie is bonkers and just so silly.
I really like it too. I mean, some of the casting throws you for a while, and it can feel off.
I think you'll love it now.
Yeah. And actually, I just said I was just I actually recently was catching up with Brian Fuller, who did the TV show, and I was like, I don't know if I've ever asked you, but what do you think of the Ridley Scott head? He's like, oh, I love it.
Yeah, yeah. That's awesome.
Of course. But it's such a different movie because I also recently picked up the Criterion Silence of the Lambs, which is a great, great addition to that. Yeah. And that movie is just like on another level. And then knowing, you know, watching the documentary on there about how they, for the longest time, they're like, it's going to be Jodie Foster. It's going to be Anthony Hopkins. And all the changing of hands and the cast.
Why couldn't they get Jodie?
She just didn't want to do it. I think that was one of those movies that they were kind of waiting for the book to be like, we're going to do a new movie, but we got to wait for Thomas Harris to finish the book. And so no one really knew what it was going to be because it's like, well, he hasn't written it yet. So what's the sequel?
And then it's too fucked up for them.
And I think she definitely did not, it wasn't in line with what she pictured Clarice being all those years later.
Yeah.
Especially the ending of the novel, which is interesting because the movie completely changes the end of the novel. And I'm like, well, what's the problem there? It's like, but once they knew that it wasn't going to be her and they got Julianne Moore, who is a pretty good Clarice. She's really good in the movie.
Yeah. No, she's a great actress. So she can do anything.
Yeah.
But then she's, Clarice, what Jodie Foster did with that character is just something really special because she's playing someone who's got this like amazing strength, but also has this interesting backstory of fear and, it's
but
a really complex
movie
thing.
Also, feels completely different than this one.
Yeah, oh yeah, no, this is a totally different.
And I think
movie.
They went more Gonzo. Once they realized that, oh, I guess we're gonna kind of, because Gary Oldman is unbelievable in his uncredited role. Ray Liotta,
the peach scene.
Oh my God, this whole thing. Yeah.
My memory. So my mom had been a huge fan, a Silence of the Lambs, and I remember that this came out while I was in college, and I came home for like a holiday weekend or something, and we were like, we're gonna go see Hannibal together, and I took her to see it, and I just remember it getting to like the brain scene or something, and she just leans over and she goes, what the fuck is going on? And then as soon as there were pigs involved, it was just, she talked about it for days.
I had seen it maybe a week or two before it came out. A rep from the company invited me to go see it in New York City. I may have even told the story before, so I'm like, oh, I'm new Hannibal, I can't wait. And we went to a sold out theater in New York City. And I'm going in my row, and it's Stephen King, his son, who I think is Show Hill, and his wife. So we're in the same row as Stephen King. And when it got to the brain scene, which is basically Hannibal feeding Ray Liotta's brain to himself, I mean, people were screaming.
They
couldn't believe what they were saying. Because you have to remember, that was never in a movie.
That shit is like Herschel Gordon Lewis camp.
That is,
I mean, it's
total
kind of
Herschel
freaking
Gordon
bonkers
Lewis
when
level.
You think about it.
And we were laughing. Me and my friend were the only ones laughing. We looked over and Stephen King was laughing too. And we were just
so
like,
good.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah.
And then like a few days later, he wrote on his Entertainment column, Entertainment Weekly column, like, I really liked Hannibal, but man, it's in bad taste. Which I thought was great.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's a lot of fun. And I think the other problem, honestly, is Anthony Hopkins captured the zeitgeist by this performance in Silence of the Lambs. And I just honestly think he's just aged too much by the time they did it again.
No,
and then Red Dragon is almost.
Yeah, he's just so old in that comparatively. And it just feels like they're trying to capture that again. And he's also doing what Freddie does, right? He's, by the end, he's getting to be
more
cartoonish.
Well, he does this thing where he's quiet and he's just like, okie dokie.
The Silence of the Lambs is such a controlled performance that it's utterly chilling how controlled that performance is. And then it just, you lose some of that.
And Silence of the Lambs, it's got a classiness to us where it just kind of like very, very slightly like drops little moments of kind of a gory horror into it, but they're very, very slight.
I will say that despite, like, of all the franchises that have changed hands so many times, this has to be one of the best because I think Manhunter is like an A+ movie.
Oh, yeah.
Science of Lambs is even better somehow, right? Like better than A+. Then you have Hannibal, which is great. Red Dragon has some really good, like Tooth Fairy. Ralph Fiennes is fantastic in it.
Oh, the cast is great.
Yeah.
It's just that Brett Ratner directed it.
Yeah, no, there's some stuff that's really good.
Semi-directed
but he does a lot of stuff that actually works. And is that it? Or is
Hannibal
there?
Hannibal Rising.
Oh, they did Hannibal Rising. prequel.
That's on with the young kid. I did watch that. It's a little. It's the making of it's fine. It's just a little dull.
Yeah, to me.
It doesn't really have another gear. But when you think about how radically different all of those are, you're like, it's amazing that it could work. And then Hannibal the show, which is also a plus.
I only think of Mads now.
Yeah, exactly.
It was very hard for me to see anybody other than Hopkins.
Yeah, and it's hard for me to see anyone but Gary Oldman. And yet Michael Pitt brings the game.
Oh my God.
Somehow Michael Pitt.
So no, that disc is terrific. And if you haven't seen the movie, it came out in 2001, so it's a pretty old movie now. But man, is it a lot of fun. I just had a blast revisiting it. And what else? Oh, really quick, Nightmare on Elm Street stuff. So I saw, I think it's still playing festivals, but it's about to get announced for an official release, which is Scream Queen, My Nightmare on Elm Street.
Really
want to
see it.
Which is the documentary about Mark Patton from Nightmare on Elm Street 2. It is terrific. Really, really terrific.
Nice.
And a great time capsule, not just about the franchise, but about Hollywood at that moment. And that's what I thought was really, you know, about being gay in Hollywood at that point in time and what that meant. And I was just really taken aback by the whole story and just this guy trying to embrace the movie that destroyed his career and his personal life. And I mean, it's funny because it's basically all leading to him desperately wanting to confront the writer. Because the writer has always said, oh, I never put gay context.
Didn't Jack Shelder also say there was no...
Yes.
As far as he knew.
So, that's the amazing thing.
How's that possible? Because we rewatched it for this draft stuff, and I was like, what the...
No, it's so over the top.
And it's all in the documentary.
Okay. Yeah, don't spoil it, because I do want to
know. Yeah, it's basically him going to each of those people
and trying to get them to task about it.
And it's really... it was far more emotional than I expected it to be.
Cool.
I thought it was really, really good.
Yeah.
You know, so hopefully we'll hear word. It's going to play a few more festivals, and hopefully we'll hear word on a release for that.
Is that shortly. So it could be something that comes to Shudder or something like that, you think?
Yeah, probably. I mean, I'm hoping we'll see it before the end of the year or beginning of next. But it's just about to finish up its festival.
The good thing about that one, besides the parts that you're talking about, which like have maybe a camper quality, but the parts that are horrific are really like the most grisly shit in any of the movies, the body horror stuff of Freddy coming out of them. Like rewatching, I'm like, wow, this stuff's crazy. And it seems to be like, it's making some pretty amazing comparisons, right? It's about coming out and stuff. It's pretty remarkable,
Yeah, it's something else. Also in front of me, this comic company called Innovation, they were only around for a very short period of time, but when they were around, they got the licenses to so many cool properties. Nightmare on Elm Street, Child's Play, Dark Shadows, Quantum Leap. They were doing like, it was like early 90s, so like maybe 91 to 93 or whatever. And they cranked them out and they were great. I mean, they were just fun because they were giving you stories that were like in between the movies or the TV shows that you loved. And then they just went under. Basically, post Freddy's Dead, the last series they did was this one that I have in front of me called A Nightmare on Elm Street, The Beginning, which was supposed to be 4 issues, and then it turned into 3, and only 2 ever came out. And then I dug into my archives, my boxes, and I found the unreleased issue 3, which I got at a convention called Fear Fest in Texas back in 2007. I totally forgot I even had this. It's not even a completed issue. It's the script with the pages, the original sketches. So you can kind of like
– wait, which number would this have been?
This would have been 3.
Oh.
And they said they capped it at 3 basically – and once the first issue came out and they realized that they were like financially under a lot of strain, they're like, we're only going to be able to do 3 of these instead of 4. And only 2 came out. And then the third one never happened. But this version was available at this Fear Fest convention. And it's really cool because even though it's titled The Beginning, they're all written by Andy Mangles. He wrote all of the Nightmare on Elm Street and Child's Play comics. He also does a ton of documentary work for like the features on like the Wonder Woman TV show releases and like odd stuff like that. And this is actually picks up immediately where Freddy's Dead leaves off. So it's all the characters from Freddy's Dead going back to the town again and kind of uncovering his backstory, which, you know, we've already seen multiple versions, and this time it's with the Dream Demon stuff. And what's fun about it as a fan, if you can go back and find these Innovation comics, because they're pretty tough to find now, is the way that this guy retconned everything. So it's all in continuity. So when they burn Freddy, it's both the guy from the TV pilot of Freddy's Nightmares, those directed by Toby Hooper,
and John Saxon's character. Like, he basically was able to loop it all in that everything you've seen, and then the dream demons are in the background from Freddy's Dead.
Weird.
So it's like, it literally takes everything you've ever seen, and it all exists within the same continuity, which is very impressive. But yeah, these are super cool. Nightmare on Elm Street, Innovation Comics. You can hunt online, or next horror convention, if you spot these, pick them up. They're wonderful.
Nice. Is that everything?
The only other thing I wanted to mention was Mindhunter.
You jumped
HBO.
In already?
Oh, yeah.
I'm done. Finished it.
I've been waiting. I need to get like some free time because I love the first season. So.
All I'll say is I think the second season is even better than the first season. I've had when we've talked about this for the last few things, especially when all that Ted Bundy stuff was coming out. I've had slight moral issues with making entertainment out of real life stuff. In fact, I saw a trade report that they're going to make Dr. Death, that podcast that I talked about.
Oh, yeah.
They're making it into a TV series with the guy from the 50 Shades movies.
Really?
Yeah. And I'm like,
wait, the guy who played the serial killer in the fall?
Yeah.
And I tried listening to that
Jamie
podcast.
Dornan.
I had problems with
it. It's terrifying.
Like, yeah.
And I don't know if I think that's inappropriate. Mm-hmm. I don't think that just happened. And I just feel weird.
I guess you won't know until you know.
Yeah, but whatever. But the point is, Mindhunter, I think, does a very interesting thing in that it is all fictitious characters. Our leads are fictitious. Mm. They're based loosely on real people. And I think it's interesting the way that they go and interview real life serial killers. And it's not like those interviews actually happened. Basically, it's an interesting way to weave in true life, true crime, and true life stories with a fictional
story.
But
a lot of that did, because a lot of it was based on his Mindhunter book that he was the guy who wrote, what is Robert saying? I read it a long time ago. But the guy who really did, was the originator of profiling, he really did interview a lot of those people back in the day. It wouldn't have happened like this.
But it's not an adaptation of
it isn't.
Those interviews or those transcripts. Yeah. It's done in a narrative way. And I mean, it's kind of interesting because people that have worked on serial killer shows, like some friends of mine, are like, you know, profiling has never caught a serial killer.
Yeah, interesting.
Never. So this method, while interesting, is not really successful. And I think that's interesting about the basically what I call the opening stories, because they do it in season two, where the opening 2 minutes, you're just seeing a random serial killer, like every episode throughout.
Yeah,
that has nothing to do with your season, and it's just kind of the they're out there. You're not going to catch them by interviewing people. It's just
I mean, they get
luck.
Caught by making mistakes. Yeah,
mistakes and dumb luck, or they want to get caught. Yeah. But this season's terrific. Cool. I mean, interesting appearances from Son of Sam, Charles Manson.
I've seen some people post photos and where it's just uncanny some of the resemblances.
Yeah, and the guy that plays Charles Manson played him in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood as well.
Yeah.
But shout out to Holt McNally. McKenley? Is that his name?
Creepshow 2.
He started in Creepshow 2, the Indian guy.
He was in a great show called Lights Out a couple years back that I loved. It was a one season, like AMC, I think it was.
Yeah.
And it was really good, and then it just went away. You know?
What's his name again?
Holt McCallany. Yeah.
Oh, there it is. It comes right up.
He plays Bill Tench, which is one of the main FBI guys. But I mean, this is a guy that's been in the business since Creepshow 2.
Yeah.
Is the Indian. He's a bit player in almost every Fincher movie. Like he pops up.
Oh yeah, there he is standing behind Brad Pitt in Fight Club.
Yep. He's the guy that says his name was Robert Paulson.
In
Fight Club. Like he always has these memorable bits. And Batman's beating him up in the opening of Justice League. So he's always there. But I love when we have those character actors and then you see him in a show like this and this is the role he was meant to be.
Yeah. And he needed
to
age a little, maybe.
Yeah. I mean, that's the other thing is there's just something about him that I can't imagine anybody else playing this character right now.
Yeah. He reminds me of the lead guy in The Wire when you watch The Wire. It's like, I've seen that guy in other things and just not been interested. But in The Wire,
he's
amazing.
Yeah.
McNally. Yeah.
Yeah. Totally. Check out Mindhunter when you get a chance.
I'm definitely looking forward to that. Cool. Well, we will be coming back with our guest. We are continuing our Beyond Fest. Choices of guests who are going to be highlighted at Beyond Fest. So we'll be back with Adam Egypt Mortimer. Severin Films will be at Monsterpalooza this weekend with hot off the press copies of Sergio Stivaletti's Wax Mask, produced by Dario Argento, from a story by Lucio Fulci. Special 2-disc limited edition slipcase and limited slip edition of Killer Crocodile with bonus Blu-ray disc Killer Crocodile 2. Come by and see us at the Monsterpalooza with all the Severin and Intervision discs on hand, including the last few copies of our out-of-print web exclusive The Vi and Combat Shock. Next week, keep your eye on the Severin Films socials and website for our Halloween release titles. three Italian productions that have never been on Blu-ray or DVD before in America. There'll be vampires, possession, and incest. So stay tuned for the Halloween Severin announcements next week on the Severin Films social media platforms and at www.severin-films.com.
Tonight's episode of Shockwaves is also brought to you by Vinegar Syndrome. Vinegar Syndrome is back with a vengeance, presenting an all-horror lineup this September. From James Hong, co-star of The Big Trouble in Little China, comes The Vineyard, a wild 80s zombie classic that's long overdue for a Blu-ray release. Then, one of the craziest horror comedies you've never seen, Paul Ziller's never-officially-on-disc rarity Pledge Night, which evenly balances its frat house set, TNA-filled hijinks with impressive gore and creature effects. Plus, one from Herb Fried, director of Graduation Day, comes Beyond Evil, a stylish supernatural horror film starring Linda Day, George, and John Saxton. Saving the best and rarest for last, Ignacio Inquino's barely-released Spanish shocker, Secta Sinestra, gets its U.S. debut in any format. This hybrid of Rosemary's Baby and The Exorcist is a non-stalled assault on good taste and deserves to be listed among the ranks of the trashiest films from Joe D'Amato and Bruno Mattei. Be sure to visit vinegarsyndrome.com for plenty of other exploitation classics and buried treasures, along with exclusive deals, sales, and limited editions. And make sure to check out the site this Friday the 13th for the unveiling of VS's mouthwatering October announcements, which include a never-on-disc slasher, more Euro horror, and their very first horror box set. Also, be sure to say hello to the Vinegar Syndrome team at the Son of Monsterpalooza in Los Angeles, MondoCon in Austin, Requiem Fear Fest in Montreal, Fantastic Fest in Austin, Lund International Fantastic Film Festival in Lund, Sweden, and as always, Cinema Wasteland in Cleveland.
All right, welcome back to the show. We are. It's weird that you haven't been on sooner, given the community of horror here and the
friends. I assumed we had, and then I had to look back through and go, no.
We do lose track sometimes.
I've been avoiding you
because he's been in to talk to my class like twice now. So yeah.
Well, sometimes it's with the right movie, and I think this is the right time. We have Adam Egypt Mortimer joining us. You might have seen Some Kind of Hate, or actually, one of my favorite things that you did was the holidays segment, which is like, is it New Year's?
I did the New Year's, yeah,
and it's it just plays beautifully on your expectations and might play even better now. I feel like in the Me Too movement, it might be even more interesting than you came out right before that.
Yeah.
But it's like, I thought it was one of the best films on that. And you're here with the new film, Daniel Isn't Real,
yes.
Which I was just telling you off air on Pure Cinema not long ago. We did a Mind Fuck episode.
Oh, man.
And this, or Mind Trip or Mind Fuck. And this film would have.
Fuck Trip?
This would be a Mind Fuck Trip. And this movie would have been perfect for that topic. But instead, you're here on this on Shockwave. So.
Yeah.
Did I just hijack this to another podcast?
I'll just Mind Fuck you right here.
All right, guys,
it's getting weird, guys.
It's getting weird.
Well,
let's start with the Beyond. Before we get into the stuff, tell us a little bit about it playing in Beyond Fest, because I know I want to make sure that you get that across.
Yeah. So Daniel Isn't Real is playing in a double feature with Color Out of Space. So I guess it's like a Spectre Vision Night of Horrors. So these are the two movies that they've made in the past year. And because it was a double feature, the tickets sold out in 4 minutes, literally four
there
minutes.
There was so much bitching online.
Yeah, and I have,
and then Ulrich texted me and was like, I got tickets. Bitching on Twitter. Yeah. What? About Beyond
Fest? Yeah, that's what we must have really in particularly offended people.
No, it totally blew up Saturday morning. That was my Twitter feed Saturday morning.
So, but it's that's complicated because it's a double feature and so many people messaged me since then being like, I tried to get tickets. I set my alarm. I couldn't, so there's people that wanted to just see Daniel Isn't Real. So I've been talking to the festival. We've been trying to figure out what to do. So what we're going to do is if you want to see Daniel Isn't Real and you don't have a ticket, if you get to the Egyptian at 9 p.m. on September 25th and line up in a relatively orderly fashion, or maybe just have a riot. I recommend them.
They're getting rowdy.
For Beyond Fest, it could go that way.
Do some Axl Rose shit, throw a chair. But no, line up at 9 o'clock, and when Color gets out, we're going to let people in. And if we have to open up the balcony to create more space, we will. But we expect that some people will leave the first movie. I want to say I can promise you that if you show up, you will get in. Because I don't want people to, I don't know, should I? Like, you wanted to see this movie. You were willing to buy a ticket. We're going to let you in for free if you get there at 9 o'clock.
Free's worth the risk.
I think it's totally worth it.
And seeing it at the Egyptian.
You stand around in the courtyard at the Egyptian, smoking your vape pen, getting your popcorn lung, hanging out with horror fans, and then before you know it, we're going to walk you in for free. That's what you get.
How about if they're out there?
Such a disgusting
term. It's the worst.
Why don't we have you agree that you're going to go out there and have conversations with people? So worst case scenario.
Oh, I will totally do that.
Yeah, so worst case scenario, they get to talk to you about a movie.
And about popcorn lung.
And I'm hoping to give away some posters.
Oh, cool.
I am making a super limited run of like 10 t-shirts.
Because
we have a very cool poster.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It won an award. That's how good this poster is.
Who's the designer? Kind of reminds me of Starry Eyes in a way.
His name is Jock. He's a British artist. He does a lot of like comic book. Mm. He's done some great. He did the Mondo poster for The Thing.
Oh, nice.
Super sick.
Yes, I know.
So I'm going to make some t-shirts with that poster that I'll probably give away to people who ask questions in the Q&A.
Nice.
What if I have an extra one or two and you're in line at 9 o'clock?
What did you shoot this on, Adam? Are there any missing scenes on the DVD release?
Okay.
What was your gadget?
Every Q&A we've done on this movie, I have loved every single person who's asked nobody's asked me any dumb question. Every question,
you didn't get the standard, like, what's your budget? How did you get the money?
Nobody has said it. Everybody has stood up and been like, talked about their emotional connection and like their light and like what and ask really interesting things. And I've started even now to say this might offend a lot of people, but I've told people I don't even mind if you stand up and say this is a comment, not a question.
Yeah.
Like I'm happy to just interact. Like I think that's the whole point, right? Mm-hmm. Is that like people come out, they want to talk to you. They don't have to ask, you know, some probing Norman Mailer level question. Yeah. Like they just want to interact. But the interaction level with this movie has been like amazing. And maybe that's because I've become a better person. When I made some kind of hate, my Q&As, I was specifically confrontational. Like I wanted to fight with people. But
I think that film might be like more in your
face. It was
face.
A movie about anger.
It's more confrontational. This has more of an in. I think there's more up. Like I think a lot of people can also relate to childhood anxieties, fears, phobias, imaginary friends, mental illness, family mental illness, like things being passed on. So there's a lot of things. I think that's a lot of ins, and it's very personal to people.
Yeah.
That's not something you stand neutrally on, you know?
Right.
And you're kind of going all in.
Yeah.
This is not a subtle, you're not dancing around the edge of this. You go all the way with this.
Yeah.
And this one has a strong kind of redemption theme going throughout. Like it definitely, I don't want to say it has a positive ending or a happy ending, but it definitely, it does have this kind of redemptive quality to it. Like there is some type of, you leave it kind of feeling a little bit more uplifted.
I'm glad you felt that way.
Well, before we delve into kind of the themes of it and stuff, because actually just today, I saw a kind of an interesting debate you were having on Twitter about nihilism versus in art and how that all plays in. But let's tell people what the movie's about and where the story is. So this is based on a novel?
Yeah, it's based on a novel called In This Way I Was Saved.
And how did you find that book?
So I met the writer at a party 7.5 years ago. It was 2011. I started trying to make this movie.
So you wrote this before Some Kind of Hate, right?
Yeah, so what happened was, so I met Brian at a party and he had just moved to LA, and I just liked him. Like you meet somebody and you're like, you're cool, I want you in my life. And he told me that he'd written a novel, so I read it that weekend and I was really caught up. I was really moved by it, and I called him on Monday and said, can I have the rights to this novel forever for no money? And he was like, that's a great deal. But he, thankfully he also said, but I'd like to write it with you because I just moved to LA and I want to be a screenwriter. So we started writing it together and we really hit it off. Like, he's a very highly educated, like he went to Princeton, he went to the New School, he got a master's in literature, but he also has an awesome collection of like vintage Iron Maiden t-shirts.
Okay, I'm in.
Right?
Yeah.
Right? This is like someone you want to hang out with. So I was like, oh, I like hanging out with him. So we got along really well writing the script. And then when we were done with a finished draft of it, I was like, okay, I've completely conned you. There's no way I can get money for my first feature for this crazy movie with, you know, like, so I was like, sorry, but what if we write another movie? And then I really hooked him in. Then I was like, now I got this guy writing other movies with me. So that's where Some Kind of Hate came from, because we were like, let's write a really low budget movie that I can get made as and have a first movie so that we can make Daniel Isn't Real. And that worked. It worked in slow motion. But over the course of the past 7.5 years, we did make those two movies. So, when you're in the middle of that time, mm-hmm. I got to talk to your class about this. Like,
yeah, be feeling like nothing's happening.
Yeah, the when you're in the midst of that time, it is the most depressing, anxious. Like, because I will every day be like, well, maybe if I die today, this is it. I have no legacy. If I find out, I mean, there would be periods of time where I'd be like convinced myself I have cancer. And then I'd be like, and I haven't done anything, and I haven't expressed myself the way I want, but then once it's happened and you've made the movies and you feel good about it, you're like, oh, that time was not, that's just how long it took me to know how to do it. And I'm trying to align myself to feel more like that second guy than the first guy has been like, I feel like my life's work now, Don't be the cancer guy. Be the, peaceful that I got to do my thing.
But that's one of the biggest themes that I think we see across the board with all the filmmakers that we bring in is you make something and then there's like a half a decade before anyone ever even remotely, looks at you again to do something. And the time in between is taxing and painful.
Yeah. It's tough.
I remember Ty West early on. I remember when he had just maybe finished Innkeepers. I remember talking to him and finding out that he was still working at like the store selling jeans or something. Just being like, because to me, he had just made it. Like you're the guy.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, that, so the realities of the, how you also have a life and how you pay bills versus how you got a movie made. Those two things don't tend to have much to do with each other.
Right.
Right. Yeah, unfortunately.
Yeah. You have to survive. I mean, the only way to have a career in LA is to not leave LA, right?
Yeah,
like, as soon as you leave, it's like, oh, I guess I'm done. But as long as you don't leave, nobody can tell you that you're done. This is, it's
because everyone knows there's a million ways to skin a cat in that sense. Yeah,
yeah.
It can take a long time, like you just said. That gives me a lot of hope to hear like that it could be 7 or 8 years and they come back to something. Do you remember what the quality in the book, like what the thing was that for you that made you zone in on it?
Yeah, so the novel and the movie is about an imaginary friend. In the movie specifically, it's an imaginary friend, childhood imaginary friend who comes back to the kid when he's a young man, when he's 19 years old. The book was a little bit more epic in the timeline. Like there's a lot of time when they're kids, there's time when they're in high school, and then there's time when they're in college. But the thing that immediately grabbed me was that it was this like world of imagination. Like in the book, it opens with this great scene where they're playing outside of the Met and they're attacked by Tyrannosaurus Rex and then they're like running around and spoiler alert, there is no Tyrannosaurus Rex in my movie.
But you have swords.
But we do have a dope sword fight and other creatures and monsters, all kinds of exciting things, but no although we do have – he has a dinosaur wallet and the kid has a dinosaur pajamas. So,
No. That doesn't replace real T-Rex.
I felt
Easter
it. All right. No, I was there for dino PJs.
They were adorable. You want to squeeze that kid?
Oh my gosh, he was so cute.
Yeah. So that idea that it's about like a world of imagination coming to life. Cause at that time I had been doing a lot of music videos and I was looking for something big and narrative that I could do as a movie. And that it took place in such a visual world. It was like imagination coming to life, but then taking this dark turn and like, how do our minds separate in a way that's separate from who we are, was so interesting to me.
And art, you've got a lot of commentary on the role of the artist and the darkness of the artist. And do you have to bifurcate yourself to be a good person or can they coexist inside each other? There's a lot of that throughout the film.
Yeah. And I think that's not what, it's kind of like something attracts you. It's kind of like falling in love. Like you meet somebody and you're like, you're hot. And then like 3 years later, you're still with that person. You'll be like, she's so brilliant. And and I like how she communicates with cats or what, like
great something.
Really, that's what
pants.
I look for in a mate.
The cat thing? Yeah. Well, I mean, it's crucial. So you're attracted to material for one thing, but then you start working with it and you have to understand it and sort of like, why did I like this? And that's when I started to understand, it's about our own darkness. Like we want to be good people, but there's a voice that comes from us that tells us not to, but that can feel like a really alien voice. So how do I, the thing why I love horror movies is because you take these anxieties, super generalizable that everybody can, and then you make it into this external crazy thing. So if we all know what it's like to quote wrestle with our demons, I like to turn that into literally wrestling with a fucking demon, So as I kind of went from, it's going to be about dinosaurs. Oh, no, we can't afford dinosaurs, yeah. But it is going to be about wrestling with demons in an externalized way. Then that was exciting.
The actual kind of demon itself and some of the aesthetics that you use surrounding how they kind of meld and separate, and it's all got these very strong aesthetical qualities. Was that in the novel? Because it's almost like a Jacob's Ladder with a lot of Cronenberg thrown in.
Well, before we move on, let's just jump on the Jacob's Ladder. It's like it has some similarities to Jacob's Ladder, but the casting.
Yeah, it has the DNA of
Jacob's Ladder.
That
right?
made me very excited when I was watching it. I think, you know, I didn't actually know who he was. You texted
I told
me.
Him.
I'm
I
sitting there watching
him,
and she goes, like, you know, that's the son of Tim Robbins
and Susan Robbins.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Like, is it? I didn't know that.
Yeah, Miles Robbins.
So and then the other guy Jacob is Schwarzenegger's son.
Yeah.
Who's really great.
Yeah. So Miles Robbins was in the Blumhouse Halloween.
2018. And he's the boyfriend.
Yeah. I saw him in a movie called Blockers, where he's super funny. It's just it's a really funny comedy. And I'm obsessed with Jacob's Ladder.
Like, it's amazing.
It's my favorite horror movie. I think it says so much about the way that trauma feels, and it's just a beautifully constructed
film. And it's a good New York movie, good horror movie, which yours is also, which is really cool.
I want to go back to my aesthetical question, I have questions about New York. But first, were the aesthetics, was that kind of built into the novel, or was that something that became...
Like the body stuff?
Yeah, the body stuff.
And be careful how much you give away. Yeah.
Right. Because people won't. Yeah. Right. So the premise of the movie is that we are privy to the point of view of this kid who can see his imaginary friend, and sometimes is it a hallucination? Is it a mental illness? Is it an overactive imagination?
Who he meets as a kid after witnessing
trauma.
Yeah, something really violent and crazy while his family is falling apart. Yeah. There's a lot happens to his mind. So one thing on an aesthetic level, one thing was I don't want it to be ghosty and wheezy woozy just because I don't like what that's not an aesthetic. That's like this thing should be, so it should be wheezy woozy.
It's all dusty and gossamer,
So usually CGI.
They do that. Yeah. And in the book, one thing that's super interesting about the novel is that it's written from Daniel's point of view. So he's the narrator.
He
has this weird disdain for human beings, and like he thinks it's gross when Luke is eating food. And the mother has this terror about like dirt and how dirt gets into your pores and how the body is made out of membranes. So there's a lot of sort of obsession in the novel about physical states. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about how the mind, even when it's playing tricks on you, it's still physical. And when you read accounts of schizophrenia, like the way that, especially the way that it was described in the 19th century, it's all about nerves, like feeling your nerves burning, your nerves stretching out or pin. And like, so to try to get that sense of physicality into this mental landscape led to things being very fleshy and tentacly and things like that is a way to express that.
It's very putty.
Yeah. Like the malleability of the flesh has a relationship to the malleability of his mind, you know? So there's a couple cool transformation sequences. There's one that's like exactly in the exact center of the movie where the camera goes around them, and it's like the movie is revolving. It was something I was like so obsessed with. Like the literal midpoint of the movie has to like physically revolve around. And that's when we did this transformation sequence, part of which I was so obsessed with the idea that we had to do something practical, not because I fetishize practical things, but because if we took these insane fleshy things on the two actors because they're transforming from one to the other and stuck their faces together, that would give us this opportunity for this like really interesting performance. Mm-hmm. So we had each of them like in the chair with prosthetic for 6 hours with these things that have magnets so that when they came to set, we could magnet them together, and then were like really stuck. And I think in the movie, it's about 4 seconds. I shot 15 minutes worth of footage because it was just like the greatest thing I'd ever seen. Like these insane, you know, morphy, tentacly things. And the two actors were so into it. And they're just like holding onto each other's faces, making these insane sounds. It sort of feel like some avant-garde Japanese ballet dance or something. And eventually the producers had to be like, okay, I think you got it.
Yeah.
So someday we could release the director's cut that's just 15 minutes of that transformation.
That could be its own short film.
Yeah.
The Entity has that great short film where the guy at the Russian guy's just taking the footage and the pulsating soundtrack, and it's its own film. It's good. That's why I'm wearing a Basket Case New York shirt for you, because there is some. I felt like there's some parallels. Obviously, totally different tone, though.
Yeah.
So, yeah, talk about filming in New York, because filming in New York is scary.
It was so hard.
Yeah.
It's so hard to shoot in New York.
I lived there for 15 years, and we were shooting for Fangoria at the time, and there were all these rules about how you had to have a crew of less than five, and you had to be on monopod, or it was like crazy fees, and the permitting process was nuts. So
it's insane, and it drove us all crazy, and none of us had, you know, Spectrevision had never done a New York movie, and I mean, it was a union shoot, which meant like we came in, we were like, here's the number of days we're going to shoot this movie. It's going to be so great. And then we found out how much we had to pay old union dudes to sit outside of their trucks, and we had to cut entire multiple days from our schedule.
Wow.
So we could afford these fucking guys who just sit there. And I mean, unions are awesome, but these unions are just really, really scary, bad news. And it, you know, and it was stuff like, there's scenes where I couldn't have somebody smoke a cigarette because we didn't have the fire guy who and the marshal and the thing and the safety. It's like, are you kidding me? Like, we're used to shooting movies where we're just like, I don't know, what if we point the camera?
Well, why? But then why New York? Besides, obviously, the book, because you already said, but it, for you, was there a greater reason why New York?
I mean, we were looking around where to the book takes place in New York. So originally we wrote it to take place in New York. And Brian grew up there and I lived in New York a long time. So there was a certain connection. But initially we had thought, what if we shoot it in Philadelphia? Mm. And we actually spent a week in Philadelphia and scouted a ton of look, and it actually looked amazing. I was very excited about the Philadelphia version because there's all these like things that used to be a pencil factory and now it's a loft and it still looks super, there's all this cool stuff. But we couldn't, the producers couldn't get the tax rebate that they wanted. So then they said, well, let's go to New York where we will get a tax rebate. But then the flip side of that is just this like union nightmare. I mean, it was really tough. I think you need more money than we did to do it. I mean, whatever, you always need more. It came out great. And the fact that there's all of the like subway shots of like, we did spend a day with, you know, we went on with no tripod and no crew, just the actors and a couple people. And we were able to shoot all of the stuff on the subways that becomes, you know, sort of the, like this motif throughout the film, which I think was so
that's
lovely.
Where I feel
really
the
makes it feel like
that's where
I like that connection there.
Yeah, it was like this interconnectivity of the city and interconnectivity of people, even though that you're constantly just passing them, that, you know, you're seeing these people and it's the city is constantly alive, even though you yourself feel alone.
Totally.
And so it worked really, really well.
No, I'm glad you felt that way. I think that was part of the idea was to do something, a horror movie that was not that could be about loneliness and isolation, but that wasn't just like, let's put them in a house in the snowstorm and make all of the colors gray. It was like, let's make it really big and noisy and manic. Like the main aesthetic was, I kept calling it kinetic maximalism. I was like, let's keep things moving and lights and colors and noise, like turn up the background noise when people are talking and make it overwhelming.
No, this was one of the first films that I felt kind of captured that, because that is one of the weirdest things about living in New York City, because I was there for so long, where you can be in this massive sea of people and feel completely and totally alone and like no one even notices that you're there. So like you feel just completely disregarded in this sea of people. And I felt that in this one. In a lot of New York horror films, it's much more about the interaction and how everybody is connected, which is also part of living in New York. But yeah, this one really did play up the isolation and the kind of the blending in.
What about other movies that, and I obviously will go back soon to like hear about you as a, you know, horror fan and burgeoning horror guy, but like another movie I saw a lot of in this, and you might not have even seen this, so it might be totally moot, Bad Influence with Rob Lowe and James Spader.
I know that movie.
The way the personality types, they feel like you if that was a horror film, it's not a horror film, right? It's Curtis Hanson, I think. Just the way the one person's kind of the bad, and I'm going to dare you, and I'm going to push you, and I'm kind of sexy and sleek, and then the other guy is a little nerdier and inhibit, but you need both sides to create the right whole in a sense. And that was a movie I just kept thinking about watching it, weirdly enough. And then the other one was Drop Dead Fred.
I think,
which I love. So I kept saying Drop Dead Daniel.
Somebody in, when we screened it in England called it Drop Dead Friedrich Nietzsche.
That's actually good.
I like that.
But I think that'd be a great double feature because the tones are nothing like each other.
They're really different kinds of movies. And I mean, I didn't see Drop Dead Fred until I didn't see it growing up or anything. So I saw it only before we shot the movie, but only because people kept saying that to me. They were like, I read your script. It's like scary Drop Dead Fred. And I was like, I don't know what that means, but I'm going to find out. And I love Phoebe Cates. Yeah. That's probably by far my favorite thing about that movie. Yeah. I don't love how it looks or how it's filmed.
Didn't perform very well. And I love Rick Mayall just because I grew up with him on Young Ones and everything. And yeah, so he's fun in that movie, but I don't remember it performing well here.
I remember seeing in New Zealand where Rick Mayall's like a big star there, but like thinking to myself, no one's going to know who this guy is in America.
Yeah.
Like,
but people love to talk about people. Yeah. People talk about that movie and about Freddy's Revenge, the second Nightmare movie. Two big Fred influences, which neither of which were a conscious influence at all, but that's sort of gotten those. I can't go anywhere without somebody saying that to me. Okay. And I'm like, don't you guys want to talk to me about Persona and Requiem for a Dream? And they're like, no, we want to talk about Freddy's Revenge. And I'm like, okay, let's have that conversation.
I'm down to talk about Persona any day with anyone.
Perceiving Freddy as an imaginary friend in that movie could completely redo a theory behind it.
That's actually kind of interesting. That's great
for watching.
Yeah.
But it's his imaginary friend who's encouraging him to come out of the closet.
Yeah.
And that scene where he does come out of his body is like he's leaning against a closet. It's so literally coming out of the closet.
We literally just talked about this like half an hour ago because we were talking about the dog.
On theme.
Yeah.
Oh, I haven't seen that. Did you see it?
No, excellent.
Rob saw it.
Excellent. Yeah. I want to go back before, because I'm sure we'll come back to Daniels and Real, but and also make sure we don't give it all away, because I'm thinking there are some things in it that will surprise people.
There's a lot of surprises. Yeah.
Yeah, like you know, from where you start.
And it's on the festival circuit now, but it's still a bit away from coming out, because this comes out in December.
It comes out December 6th.
Oh, wow. Okay. So, yeah. That's wow.
So we're going to do, we got Beyond Fest, and then I'm showing it in Brooklyn next month at the Brooklyn Horror Film Festival, which is going to be great, because... Finally, you know, we shot in Brooklyn. There's so many people. Oh, cool. So I'm really excited to go to Brooklyn. And we're going to Sitges.
Oh, cool.
Nice.
And then eventually.
Oh, we didn't talk about Sasha Lane either, by the way. Sasha Lane is from American Honey.
Yeah.
And we just talked about Elf Ear, which is a role, Andre Arnold film where you can't, it's like she wasn't even an actress, right, when she did this film. And it just will blow your mind. It's like one of the great performances.
Yeah, I saw that movie at Fantastic Fest a couple years ago, and I was just crying. I was just sitting there at the Alamo crying and immediately thought, well, I have to cast her for this movie I'm trying to make. And thankfully, she loved the script and wanted to do it. But she's just amazing. She brings so much like life and excitement, and she's just so cool to be around. I was so happy we had her in the movie.
Yeah. What were you going to say, Rob?
I was going to say it's also playing at Knoxville Horror Fest, which we're all going to.
We're all headed there.
No way.
Yeah, are you coming?
So we'll rep
when is that? I didn't even know about that
October 17th through the 20th.
Yeah.
So that's the same time as Brooklyn. That's when I'm going to be in
Brooklyn. We'll be there for you.
We'll be
representing it. He said to us it was Drop Dead Fred mixed with bad influence. Was his...
and Persona something. I didn't listen to it. So let's go back a bit. So before all this and before hashtag Death Wave, let's go back to the
hashtag death wave.
I wasn't going to touch on it, but now that we're here,
you saw that there was a death wave party just this past weekend at that Heather Buckley hosted a death wave party.
Let's back up. Let's talk about the death wave thing. Can you walk us kind of through?
I remember the day it all happened because I think a lot of us in defense of death wave before it got trampled on by on Twitter is I do think there was a lack of a name to all of this that was happening, and I think it's funny because there was all these cool movies coming out, and you know, Mumblegore was one thing that got thrown around. It was terrible, right? You don't want that. And then I remember the day it popped up, and I just remember everyone like losing their fucking minds around.
We were doing the Blumhouse website, and like we've never gotten more anger and backlash on anything.
Isn't that such a strange thing?
Ever.
Maybe we created outrage, and we have not gone back ever since.
I was all
you led
for
to
it.
Trump. You led Death Wave directly leads to Trump.
Now I know why everybody was mad. It created Trump. Yeah,
but no one. I doubt that all of our listeners understand the
Death Wave. Yeah, so go back.
Thing.
Explain what you did.
Walk us
what
through what I did.
What have you done?
Explain why it took you so long to make this movie. It was because of this moment.
Yeah, I was shunned from. So when I made my first movie, Some Kind of Hate, I was coming from a place where I didn't know a lot of other filmmakers in LA. Like I had lived here for a while, and I had done. I was a professional director in music videos, and I did a documentary about hip hop dancers and stuff like that. But I made this movie, and through that movie, I got to meet a bunch of new friends who were all people involved with horror. And like, I hadn't been to a film festival ever in my life. Like, hadn't really been surrounded by people into genre. It just wasn't. It wasn't like a community world I came from. It was obviously I was a horror person, but really like alone in it, right? And then suddenly I was surrounded by people who were making movies that in some ways were like my, like the like personal, you know, intensely motivated horror movies.
So this would be around filmmakers. Like Starry Eyes, yeah. Joe Bickus' yeah. first film. Exactly, yeah, these all are, those guys, these are Travis Stevens, about. All that
exactly.
Guy.
Like, I mean, seeing Horrible Way to Die mm-hmm. is Adam really Rivers, what yeah. what made me want to make some kind of hate. Mm-hmm. Like, I saw Horrible Way to Die and I saw Martyrs, and I was like, I think I finally understand why I'm interested in horror movies. Mm-hmm. So that stuff was really important to me. And so there I was. I just made this movie, and Josh Ethier was my editor. Josh Ethier, who has
on
done
the show last week.
Yeah. So he kind of introduced me to some people, and mm-hmm. and suddenly I'm sort of standing around looking at Joe Bagos and looking at Dennis and Kevin and Mickey Keating and all these, and everybody, and you know, everybody had like Videodrome tattoos. And I don't mean to sound like I grew up in like the forest or something, but yeah. I just didn't know a lot of people with Videodrome yeah. tattoos. Yeah. And suddenly I was surrounded by them, and they were all talking about horror movies the way that I had been thinking about them, but I hadn't been talking to anybody in real life about it.
You're
and
talking
I was like,
to your imaginary.
Yeah, I was talking to my imaginary fucking friend. Yeah, yeah. And I was like, wow, this is a thing. Like, this is really a thing. And I'm so excited about this thing. And like, it's so, like, thank God I have some other people around. Like, I've met a crew. Like, this is incredible. And I started writing about it. I started writing sort of just on my secretly in yeah. my whatever, not journal, but about like what are these kind of what is this? And I was like, I feel like Larry Fessenden yeah. invented a kind of horror the way that John Cassavetes mm-hmm. invented a kind of drama, mm-hmm. and that all of these, because a lot of them had worked for him or his assistant or
it's
whatever.
Like Corman School, but now it's
yeah,
Fessenden.
Yeah, it's like Fessenden. You know, Jen Wexler, who just yeah. made The Ranger, uh-huh. like she's produced like most of his recent movies, things like that, and so all these people, and so I started writing something, and I had just recently seen the futurist art show at the Guggenheim in New York, which the futurists, Italian futurism from like the 20s, and they wrote an incredible manifesto, the Futurist Manifesto. Uh-huh. So I was like, I'm going to write a manifesto. And I sort of started writing it, and I sort of Tumblr'd it a little bit, yeah. but then I got lazy. This is where I fucked up. Instead of like doing some weird, mysterious performance with like me and Noah Sagan covered in cat blood, like yeah. reading a manifesto, I was just like, well, let me just talk about it.
I'll just tweet it.
I just have some ideas. And so it was a way to, it was a couple things. One, it was a way to talk about film aesthetics, which is like really the thing that I'm most obsessed yeah. with. What's the difference between like a low budget exploitation horror movie and an indie horror movie? Does that have a meaning? You know, what are the difference in our intentions? How do we classify these things? It's important for people to understand that. And I had found this when I was making some kind of hate. The most important thing when I would talk to actors or other crew was I would have to be like, this is a slasher movie, but really it's a drama. Let me tell you why these emotions are real. Like the emotional pain is as important as the – like I had to really make sure that everybody understood.
It's that concept
take this
of
seriously.
If I took the horror element out, you're still interested in this film. Yeah,
yeah. yeah. And that the horror element is expressing something, yeah. right? So somehow I got it in my head to call that Death Wave.
You don't remember where that part comes from?
Good at coming yeah. up with cool names.
Yeah, yeah. yeah. But are you basing it on?
Well, where it came from was this dark figure. No, I mean.
No, but like it's music. Like music, you obviously used
yeah,
a lot of
totally.
New wave and yeah.
Shockwave.
Well, yeah. I mean, so I had made this document. This is really where it came from. Not the name, but the idea of the name. I had made this documentary. It was a series about hip hop dancers in Watts called Jerk All Stars. And in like 2010-ish, 2009, 2010, there was a movement called the Jerkin movement. Like there was, and it was like a kind of dance and a kind of music. And so I met all of these like 16-year-old kids, and they kept talking about how what they were doing was a movement. And it was like the first iteration in LA where like young black kids were wearing skinny jeans and bright colors, and they were like, this distinguishes us from all these old assholes in baggy pants who are in gangs. Yeah. And we're not in gangs, we're jerkers. And it was so fascinating to me how they were sort of coming together to do this like community thing that had meaning and that distinguished them from people. And I was like, that's what we're doing. Mm. So I was like, and it's Death Wave. I don't know why. I mean, that's I'm obsessed with death. Like everything I do is I'm just obsessed with death.
Yeah,
and it was a wave. So they, you know.
And so what? But how did I don't because I can't remember. I remember the day
Jerry Smith wrote about it in Blumhouse.
Yeah. Yep.
Because he, I guess I had tweeted when I was just tweeting about it. It hadn't yet gotten. Out of hand.
And we, Jerry came to me and wanted to do it. And I had just seen Some Kind of Hate, which I really like. I love Grace Phipps in that movie
so much.
She's so good. And I remember that he came to me and asked to do it. And I was like, yeah, let's try it and see how it does. And it literally like broke the site.
I mean, Adam Wingard tweeted, Death Wave makes me want to stop making horror movies.
Yeah.
And I was reading shit like this being like, what is wrong with everybody?
You were inspired directly by
his Isn't that weird? Yeah. I still haven't met him yet. If I ever do, I'm going to have to a little bit bust his balls.
I just, I mean, I was happy to fan those fuel, the fire, because I just thought it was such a non-issue and such an elitist thing. Because here was my comparison, especially when Jerry pitched it. I was like, you know what? David Scow once said out loud, splatterpunk.
Yep.
And that became a thing.
And he called himself
And now
that.
People know what splatterpunk is. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's like, it's not up to you to decide filmmakers that don't want to be called something. It's like somebody said something that's kind of cool and it just kind of sticks.
And at some point, somebody said, we're the masters of horror. And thus, and they still identify themselves as that.
I know, the people that got mad at me, I really feel like they didn't understand this opportunity. You know, like we could have just all gotten more famous.
Yeah,
you guys fucked it up. I'm so sorry that I said I really like, and all I was saying was, I'm so happy to have met all these cool people who are doing all these cool things. I look forward to making more movies with all of them. And they were like, "Fuck you!"
Well, and it was a lot of the people within the scene. Like, I mean, I can't remember. Did Travis embrace it?
Travis was, but he was cool about it.
Yeah,
like there are people who like angrily called me a douchebag on the internet.
Yeah.
This is the first time I'd ever been called a douchebag on the internet. It's something we have to all go through. It's a matter of just being a human now, but. Travis wasn't like that. He was like, I think this is wrong. Here's a reason, whatever. But other people just like lost their mind. But the day that that article came out and everybody was flipping out about it was I had just landed in Mexico. I was at the Morbido Festival showing my movie.
Great festival.
It's so much fun. Yeah. And so I was like, it didn't bother me.
Yeah.
I was like, this is crazy, but I'm in Mexico showing my horror movie to cool Mexicans. Yeah. So fuck off.
You're showing it to some Death Wavers, I think. Yeah. Morta, maybe if you'd flipped it to Morta, what would it be? Death Wave, Morta. What's Wave? We got to figure this out because that
Spanish?
Could be even cooler.
Yeah.
Yeah, Morta. Yeah. Anyway.
It would be.
Could be much more badass.
Yeah.
Maybe that's where you went wrong. You should have labeled it when you're in Mexico. Anyway. Sorry, tangent.
I say we bring it back.
Yeah. I mean,
is this what tonight's about? Us bringing back?
Actually, it's not Beyond Fest month. This is Death Wave month.
Yeah.
Death Wave month.
Because you're right. It actually it is.
Wait a sec, guys.
Oh, it's all of them. Sorry.
Thus we have started.
Sorry, Travis Stevens.
Yeah. Well, he's going to be part of it.
Yeah, he's in. So yeah,
he can rebut. I mean, I'm not even defending a point anymore. I'm just describing a thing.
Well, how do you
that
think
I was
about
excited
it
like, about 5 years
in that
ago.
Yeah, because in that moment, did it make did people's reactions make you rethink even what you're thinking, or did you realize, or is it just people's fear of being labeled, like it becoming a label?
Yeah, it did not make me rethink. I still think it's true. You call it what you want to call it, but it's true that there's a different kind of horror movie, and obviously, I was 100% correct because look at that. You know, it's only gotten more so now.
Well,
right?
You know,
studios are chasing the vibe that I was describing.
I think the word that the much 100 times worse word that they're using is the idea of elevated horror, because even though
elevated
that's
horror.
Often being used in studios, that is what they're talking about. They are talking about movies. I feel like the word elevated horror tends to be used about when it's something emotional or something that taps into something real. And then it's a horror film. I think
for
that's,
me, elevated horror is usually when it's adult issues.
But that's most of these things are adult
actually, you're
in
right,
that sense. I'm saying I know it's also like, oh, we put stars in it, so it's elevated, or it's Ari Aster, it's elevated. But I do think they're using that same term to just go, it's a horror film about something.
I think it means, I think it means that the filmmaking is
good.
Has intention.
Right.
You know, and I think that.
But that's what
Basket
we should want
Case,
from every movie.
Basket Case is also an interesting movie to some people more than others.
Yeah.
And I the thing that distanced me from that movie is the filmmaking.
Right.
And by that, like the performances are not good.
Yeah.
Like I don't believe that these are people. I see them as being in a movie.
Yeah. But you also only saw it recently, right? Like, had you seen that when you were young?
Yeah.
Like,
maybe, but still.
Yeah.
It's what you're saying, because if the performances aren't there and the design of the film isn't there, the emotions don't seem true.
Right.
So then you're just watching this movie because there's a big rubber prosthetic raping a woman with a horrible sound and nothing behind it that makes that. I mean, it's still a metaphor. It's still something. I'm sure Hinkenlooper had an anxiety that he was expressing.
I think
it's
more
clearly
in that movie.
Not elevated. You can't. I'm not saying it's a good or bad movie, but I'm saying I don't know what elevated means, but it doesn't describe Basket Case.
I think if nothing else, we can all probably agree on that.
There has to be a base. There has to be a baseline of agreement, and Basket Case is the fucking base.
So the article Basket headline. Basket Case 2, though, I don't know.
But the headline coming out of this episode is Basket Case is not Death Wave.
Right, that's the headline.
That's all we're going to know.
But I can imagine a studio meeting happening right now, maybe next in the office next door to where we are, where somebody is saying, we're doing a Basket Case reboot. We want to find like the elevated version.
Yeah, right.
Totally. And I can
wait, what's
take
that? Blumhouse is doing Basket Case.
Yeah. So Blumhouse is rebooting Basket Case.
No, Ryan just tweeted and said that is fact.
From the directors of The Lodge.
Yeah.
Follow. Riley Keough is going to play the mutant twin. It's actually two girls now.
Yeah. Totally so elevated, all about adult issues.
Yeah, they just flipped it to him. Yeah.
I need to clarify that is not true because even just last week we got in trouble for something that we said.
Oh, did we get in trouble? I didn't get the memo.
Yeah, that is not true.
But Predator Purge is happening.
Predator Purge is the greatest
crossover I've ever pitched.
In your mind, Owens, I expect the Dark Horse comics version of that before an actual movie. But who knows?
Okay, so it's still out there. But what's interesting is nothing did ever replace that. Like they never really did coin terms. It's just indie horror and it's festival horror and it's
Travers' point, maybe we don't need terms.
No, you don't necessarily need terms.
And I mean, I think that it's all just trends because even like this elevated horror trend, we had it in the 70s as well, where we had these like thinky horrors like Don't Look Now, where it's about adult issues and something fucked up happens in it too.
Yeah.
Or Burnt Offerings or The Changeling, they're all kind of adult thinky horrors that are a little bit more elevated.
Even The Exorcist or Rosemary's Baby, like those are Academy Award
prestige
winning movies,
right?
That are horror. Yeah. I mean, I think we needed to to talk about elevated only because of the 80s. Like, I think up until then, like, you can keep going back. Like, Psycho was a horror movie, right?
Yeah.
I mean, Frankenstein was a horror movie. And these movies were not like, oh, these are trash. There was B movies that were horror movies, and there were A movies that were horror movies, right? I mean,
yeah, you could say you have material that isn't maybe A material, but it is elevated by these class A directors who are coming to make it. That part is true.
Yeah, I will say, I think that the trend definitely followed was prior decades, and this wasn't always the case, and I will point to Larry Fessenden, but prior decades, if you were going to make a low-budget horror film, it fell more into the kind of B category. It was a very Corman-ish thing if you were going to make something that fought against mainstream and was low-budget. But that was one of the first times where I'll say that there was a saturation of filmmakers working on a lower budget who weren't aiming for B material. They were aiming for something completely different. I think Larry Fessenden did that with like an Abel Ferreira to a degree with some of their stuff, but
there's a reason it's been often seen as an exploitation genre, and that is because a lot of people, especially in the 80s, did exploit it, and people who don't really give a fuck about horror films were going, oh, how do I break in? I make a horror film. That, to me, is one of the reasons it has a reputation of being a B-genre. But those people who really love it and really believe in it and have something to say will always make it worth it.
But it's funny. When Noah Baumbach makes a movie, why don't we call that an elevated comedy? You know, like the 80s comedies were just, you know, Porky's not a good movie. I mean, maybe it's good in a sense, but it's exploitation.
But it's because horror's always been the dwarf stepchild, right? It's always
been. Right, but I want,
but
we're saying that it hasn't been because both Rosemary's Baby and Exorcist were Academy Award winning films.
Oh, but that doesn't matter because it will always be kind of the stepchild of
You're allowed one of those a year.
Yeah. Not even a year. We get like one a decade.
Right, yeah.
Like we had our Get Out. We're not allowed another one for a while.
No, I mean, and we don't believe that, obviously.
Right.
Yeah. It'd be kind of sad if we did. But I do think it's because, I don't want to say because most horror is trash, because that's not the answer, but I do think people have used that genre just as the break-in. And anytime I hear someone go, I want to break in, so I'm going to do a horror, I'm like, fuck you.
No,
like,
and even still, I mean, I was at AFM a year ago pitching to somebody, and it was a producer who had never done horror before, and he looked at me in a perfectly straight face and was like, yeah, I really wanted to meet with you because you know horror and it's low-hanging fruit.
Yeah.
And it was like my
Did you slap him?
No, but I did. I was like, that's really kind of the wrong approach to get in. No, not even.
We're in his office right now.
And that man was Jason Blum.
And now I'm in trouble.
Now Elric is no longer
the bat phone is lighting up. Ryan's calling us on the bat phone. We are in deep shit. Sponsorship pulled.
This is what happens when you leave us, Turek. It goes bad.
The kids get naughty.
No, but I mean that, but the fact that that attitude still prevails, that it is kind of a low-hanging fruit, or if we're looking to make a quick buck, oh, we'll make a horror film. Like, it's a throwaway genre.
And you see it. And you can usually tell. They're saying, I don't even want to get into the name code, but I've seen movies where by the end of the day, there's something inside you just, it's very much like looking at, what's that great philosophical term when you look at the android face or the thing that CG that...
Oh, that would be the uncanny valley.
The uncanny valley feeling. I feel like something similar happens with horror films where I feel like, sure, the aesthetics might be good. There might be some stuff about its work. It's not just cheap crap, but I feel no intention behind the vision. And I feel like the person's just doing this to tick boxes because they've been told this is the gig. And that's fine. Like directing for hire, no problem. But there's something about when you see, when you do see a film with like a Starry Eyes or something where you do feel the passion behind it or that they had to tell that story and this is the best medium for that story. Mm-hmm. I think that's when these things really pop out. And that's Death Wave. That is what makes
way to bring that back around.
Yeah, okay.
It's been a long time since I was called a douchebag on the internet. Yeah. So
thanks for bringing it back.
Hopefully somebody will.
Thanks, Kane.
Hopefully I'll get you some love. Death Wave is real. Not Daniel's real. Just gonna say Death Wave is real. I want that to be a shirt.
So tell us, when does the movie come out?
The movie comes out on December 6th. It's being released by Samuel Goldwyn Films. It'll be in a couple theaters and it'll be on, wherever you buy movies and watch them. And then Shudder has an exclusive for streaming, which is cool. I love Shudder. Mm-hmm. That'll be a couple months after.
But we're not done because Rob questions that I always think is super important for people. I want to know those horror films that made you when you were young and
why we're here. We all have that moment when we're a kid and we finally discover the stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so what were the movies that made you fall in love with the genre and just like, oh wow, I can't believe you could do that in a movie.
Well, I think that my family getting a VCR coincided with me first watching horror movies. Mm-hmm. And it also coincided with me first finding out who Tom Savini was. And when I was 12 years old, I thought that when I grew up, I was going to be a special effect artist like Tom Savini. And so seeing Dawn of the Dead on a VHS tape, I distinctly remember seeing it with a group of friends. And it doesn't feel like it blew my mind, but I've just felt like it made sense to me and I was into it. But it wasn't like there were other things that didn't make sense. You know what I mean? Mm. But that's my first horror movie that I enjoyed watching. But prior to that, I had seen American Werewolf in London when I was too young to see it. Mm. And I had to leave halfway through. Saw it in a theater, and my uncle had to take me out of the theater because I was losing my mind. Just the scene, the nightmare where the Nazi pigs come in and butcher his family. And I had nightmares for months. I was so afraid. And I hadn't even seen half of the movie. And I feel like that sense of trauma from seeing a movie is like when I think about some of my other favorite, the next time I had that feeling was when I saw Pink Floyd, The Wall.
Oh,
it was
nice.
One of my favorite movies of all time. And I think that we don't talk about that enough as a movie, like a great Alan Parker cinematic experience.
Or even how horrific it is, the nipple
it's
slicing.
So
I remember fucking me up the first time I saw it.
It's such a terrifying, the whole tone of it is so dark and just terrifying and existential and visual. I remember seeing that at the beginning of a summer on VHS and feeling nauseous, like an unbroken sense of nausea for 3 months that entire summer. And I think that's something that I look for in movies now. And then I felt it again when I saw Martyrs. Yeah. When I saw Martyrs, I was like, there's something so beyond about
the word
this movie.
I always use for that, and it takes a long time before you figure out what it is, but I always go, there's a dangerous quality, like they're doing something different beyond the rules. Martyrs, definitely. I mean, you felt a little fright. I was even worried to watch that because I'd heard things, and it was the first movie in a long time I had that feeling, and then suddenly it actually delivered on it.
Yeah, totally.
And you don't know where they're going to take you. They've got you, you're in the darkness, and you have no idea because we're so educated on films now. We understand them so well structurally. There's so many screenwriting books that you're basically safe.
safe.
Yeah.
You're almost guaranteed safeness because you already know the ride. So anytime somebody deviates that and does it really well, I remember Kill List is one. I mean, it's more entertainment than it is truly dangerous, but there's movies that really take you in a different direction. It's a great feeling.
Yeah. When I sat down in the theater just a couple months ago to see Climax, the new Gaspar Noé movie, I was like, oh, we're going, cool. And then suddenly I was sitting in the chair and the lights started going down and I was like, oh, fuck, I'm about to see a Gaspar Noé movie. I don't think I'm ready for this.
Yeah.
And like I felt this incredible sense of anxiety, which is a horrible feeling, but also something that I really chase. It's so hard to come by, which I try to create. Like that's my thing. I'm about a cinema of anxiety. Like I want to make you feel tense the whole time. And I saw Climax, but then halfway through Climax, I realized that it was a slapstick comedy. And then I just couldn't stop laughing the whole way through.
Even though I enjoyed Climax, I felt let down because I spent the entire movie waiting for the Gaspar Noé moment.
She kept criticizing the dance. You don't know too much about dance.
There was only, dancing was the opening.
Yeah.
You don't think that the young child on acid locked into a room screaming for his mom that there were cockroaches was not a Gaspar Noé moment?
That's the most I've heard Brian Collins laugh all year.
Yeah, Brian Collins was sitting next to us and did not stop laughing.
That movie is like Planes, Trains, and Automobiles for psychopaths. Yeah. Like that's what Climax is. I fucking love it.
But it's funny that feeling you're talking about, the last time I felt that like really extremely in a movie was Gaspar Noé was there introducing that movie Angst that they had just made.
That movie was insane.
The most I felt that, because it was also in a theater. No one knew this movie. At that point, this was before the release, no one had even heard of it. And he brought this thing over and it was really hard to get a copy. And the way he screened and just talked about how much he loved it, there's that Cine Family before it went under. And I just remember going, oh, that felt like I was underwater for 2 hours, trapped in a guy's perspective. And it is a terrible perspective to be stuck in. It's utterly incredible, the filmmaking. And then then going up to Gaspar Noé after, and also Irreversible had that influence on me, going up to him and he's just the most joyous, smiley, fun guy. And you're like, this is great.
Because it's such a breakthrough film. But it's interesting. I mean, compare Angst to Basket Case, right? It's they're both really unhinged, really dangerous films.
Yeah. Well, that totally is my favorite double feature.
But Angst is like, there's something in the film, like it's this thing that I was trying to suggest before, where like the film, there's a technique in that movie, I don't even understand what it is, where he's shooting through a mirror and everything.
Low angle shots.
And the performances are so real, you feel like you're actually just watching a sociopath, whereas Basket Case is great in a totally different way.
Yeah.
And there's something about what, like, I don't ever want to make Basket Case, but I would be interested in making Angst.
It's intent, artistic intent, but the only reason, like, there's a lot worse movies, but Basket Case, one thing about Henlotter is he actually achieves his intent in all his movies, but his intent has this, like, other weird comic side to it these other movies
don't. Achieves the hell
right,
out
so
of it.
He's getting his thing. A lot of people don't even get near it, right? But the difference is the grounding of reality. And he's not obviously interested in reality, right? It's like a surrealist, hyper, over the top quality. But the movies you're talking about, I feel very similar. I would never make Basket. I love Basket Case, but I'm interested in grounding shit. So whatever that is happening, people believe it's real.
Yeah.
And because you feel it as 100%. Reality. That's why Don't Look Now and things like that have that same quality. It feels like these are real people suffering real things. And therefore, I'm a real person. So I project into it. And when it's something comic or removed, it's a different feeling. You can enjoy that too, but you can't necessarily feel it in the same way.
Yeah. Totally.
But again, that's also taste. Everyone's got their, whatever their bag is, I guess.
Yeah. And this is why, you were asking about horror movies that kind of got me going, and you had mentioned Cronenberg before. Cronenberg is such a big deal to me. Mm-hmm. And when you look at The Fly, which is a movie I watch over and over again, like it feels so real and it's so relatable as a movie that is, this is the structure of what a love affair feels like. This is what it feels like to fall in love and be excited and inspired by that and then fuck up and then it falls apart and then regret and then suicide, emotional suicide. Like it's so relatable. And even though nobody in the world would be able to build a teleporter by themselves in a warehouse,
we totally buy it.
You still believe it. It feels so legitimate the way he's like, well, I ordered this part and this part and da da, because this performance is unreal and the look of it is so perfect. So it just feels real. And then once you feel real, and then, what he did with Videodrome, which is a movie made entirely of hallucinations that somehow feels more physical and real than most movies that are supposedly grounded.
Well, you know what I love about that one? I think maybe you told me about Videodrome. Panos Cosmatos said Yeah, he saw it on the big screen. It didn't work for him.
I felt the same fucking thing. They showed that
idea about watching it on video.
100%. I've been saying this too because I finally saw it on a big screen for the first time last year when Beyond did the Cronenberg stuff.
Yeah,
and I was like, I can't believe I'm finally seeing Videodrome. And this is a movie I've watched Videodrome at home more than any other movie ever.
Yeah.
I've seen it so many times, and I was totally uninterested in it in the theater.
Yeah.
I was like, this isn't – and they showed it in a double feature with – I can't remember what it – Existence or maybe
– It was Existence.
Yeah. And the other one was great. And I was like, holy shit, I didn't – I mean, I love all of his movies, but I was like, I can't believe that in the double feature, the other one is really jumping out to me. And Videodrome feels boring. Watching that movie at 2 in the morning by yourself on a television is – the greatest experience, and I don't, you know, I wonder how, I mean, he was such a visionary that maybe he even knew that making it. He was like,
he probably knew most people are going to watch on VHS.
Yeah, eventually it'll come out on VHS, even though that was only just a thing then. But it is, it's the only movie on earth that I would be like, it's my favorite movie. Don't see it on a big screen.
It is bizarre. I mean, the only other thing I'd say about The Fly that's so amazing about that movie is that Cronenberg's reputation of being so cold, and it's true of most of his films. Like you look at Crash, it's just this cold, the way he approaches the emotion. And yet The Fly is one of the warmest.
Oh, it's great.
At the center of it.
The love story is so good.
Yeah, the way they connect. And again, they were a real couple, I believe, at the time. And it's really, I love showing that to film classes like on February 14th, because to me, it's like the perfect one to just hit you with for Valentine's Day. But yeah, no, it's such a great movie. You haven't done a romance yet, have you?
Well, there's romance in everything I do. Yeah, I mean, New Year's was about a blind date.
It's
you know,
a death wave romance, I guess.
And I always have, there's always a sexuality, like both some kind of hate and Daniel Isn't Real have what I call like metaphysical sex scenes, like sex that, like in some kind of hate, it was just when they're cutting themselves and the wounds. And because I was like, what, I want to see sex with a monster, but I want it to be consensual. Like I really hope I can make it through my entire career without having to film a rape scene.
Yeah.
Like I just, if I'm ever in that, you know, like I'm just tired of seeing them. Like as much as I love The Babadook, I don't know if I'm ever going to be able to see Nightingale, whatever. So, but I was like, but I want to. I almost said, I want to have sex with a monster. I want to depict sex with a monster. Maybe I do want to have sex. I want to depict sex with a monster. So it was like, what's the way into that that would be okay for me to film? And so in some kind of hate, it was this like strange consensual cutting thing that is shot like it's a sex scene. Mm-hmm. And then in Daniel Isn't Real, I actually depict consent because that was such a crucial thing for me. So that because there's two sex scenes and then the second one is very metaphysical and strange.
Yeah.
But, sorry, what are we talking about?
Monster sex.
And
no,
you know,
you're a romantic guy, and you've made romantic movies.
Thank you.
That was
I
it.
Guess she gets me.
Yeah,
I guess. Yeah. Okay.
No, because the entire first part of Daniel Isn't Real was all about him wanting connections and wanting love, and then he finally finds it. And how disappointed was he when you know things happen?
Yeah, we can't. I guess talk about that part.
But I can't. I mean, spoiler alert: like he and Sasha Lane playing in an abandoned school bus depot with cool electronic music playing, and that's not romantic.
I didn't say
they
weren't. I just said you hadn't made a straight romance.
A straight romance.
That's my challenge.
Well, I would make like a straight monster romance.
Yeah, well, that's my challenge.
They should give me Bride of Frankenstein. Is what I'm saying.
Ah,
who was tapped to do that recently? It was the Candyman 2 director, right?
Bill Condon.
Yeah, Bill Condon.
Oh, really?
Candyman. You went to Candyman 2?
Yeah,
it's over gods and monsters.
And I don't feel embarrassed about it at all. At least I didn't do Dreamgirls, right? I think that's him. Maybe not. I think it is.
Wow.
Yeah. Anyway. All right, that's the end.
Well, it's exciting. Are you really quick question, and it can tie into what you're up to next. You know, with Some Kind of Hate, I remember when that came out and there was a lot of buzz around it. How did that influence kind of what came next? Because it's always interesting. It's interesting to educate our listeners who are also filmmakers.
Yeah. That as far as the career path.
What kind of opportunities were open because of Some Kind of Hate? Because again, Daniel Isn't Real was the first movie you really wanted to make, but to get there, you had to make that film. Yeah.
And it went exactly as planned because when I was working on Some Kind of Hate, I wanted Spectrevision to produce it. Like I think they were even called Woodshed back then, and I was trying to find them and I was sending them emails and asking people I knew who knew them. I was like, they're my people. But of course, I never heard back from them. So I made the movie. And then when it premiered at Stanley Fest, which is what is now the Overlook Festival.
Yeah.
And Spectre Vision was there. They had two different movies there. They had Cooties and The Boy. And the first day I was there, I saw Josh Waller from Spectre Vision sitting at breakfast at the hotel, like with his laptop. And I introduced myself to him. And I was like, I've been really trying to get in touch with you guys. I have a movie. I hope you'll see it. And he opened his laptop and found, he was like, oh, I see all of these emails that you sent me. Unreplied. And I was like, it's cool, man. You're busy. Like, it's all good. But then he saw the movie and he liked it. And he had all of his other partners see it too. And so that led to me. And I can't remember if we talked about this before when I was at your class, but so I went to, they were like, we love this movie. What else do you have? And I went to meet them and I had a very intense pitch for a movie. It was not Daniel. It was a different movie that I thought this is the movie that Spectrevision would want to make. It's this very sort of David Lynchian romantic breakup horror drama set in Singapore. And the whole drive there, I was like rehearsing the pitch and like I had a lookbook and all these, I'd been to Singapore, taken all these pictures. And we had this great meeting where, these kind of meetings is like first you just talk and get to know each other, then you finally picture thing. And I got like half a sentence into this thing and Dan was like, sorry, I'm just going to cut you off there. We're not really interested in making movies like that anymore. I was like, he was like, yeah, that sounds really like small and kind of experimental. We're trying to like kind of get a little bit bigger. And I was like, and I was like, okay, well, I also have this movie about an imaginary friend. And he was like, that sounds amazing. Send me the script. So I didn't have, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then they all read the script and they loved it. And they were like, let's make this movie. So it happened exactly as planned. Make the tiny movie that you scrape together with money from friends and family and whatever. And then it turns out just good enough that the people that you want to work with give you a chance to do the next slightly bigger thing.
Did the movie Holidays in Between help? And that's, or is that
It helped in a way because that movie, I mean, first of all, I got to meet all those cool filmmakers, you know, so I was like, oh, I'm making a Death Wave anthology. Fuck everybody. who's the douchebag now, internet? And then it played at Tribeca, which was quite fancy. So that was the fanciest thing I've ever been a part of up until that point in my life. And I got like an agent out of that and things like that. Whether or not that helped exactly with the thing that made Daniel happen was because the material was cool and Spectrevision was doing it. Yeah. And, you know, I think, I don't know what, nothing's ever linear.
Yeah.
You try to draw a line and then it becomes a squiggle.
A mess, yeah.
Yes. Does that answer your question? Oh, important thing that I wanted to say about it is that on Some Kind of Hate, I didn't know how to make a movie. Like I'd directed a lot. I'd done music videos and things, but I really didn't know how to make a movie. And I was learning how to make a movie while shooting it. I was like, what is blocking? Like, I understand I want to do I have a thing I want to communicate, but how do I do it? What's a performance? I had like taken all these acting classes and stuff just before shooting it because I hadn't really worked with actors yet. And I was trying to understand. So I was really like learning how to make a movie. And with Daniel Isn't Real, I applied everything I learned and like really made a movie.
Yeah. All right. And cool. What about, can you talk at all about what's next or are you just focused on this release for right now?
I have another movie that I'm working on with Spectrevision. That's a really cool thing that I love. That's not a horror movie, but it's still, you know, it's still genre. It's very strange and we're hoping to put it together and I can't say anything about it yet because it doesn't exist. It's not a thing, but hopefully it'll be a thing. And then I'm just reading a lot of scripts. Like the nice thing about having made Daniel Isn't Real is that I'm receiving way higher quality of scripts than I had before. Cause so far, like I've written the movies that I've done, I've written graphic novels. I write a lot. I don't like writing. It's not my goal. My goal is to be shooting. I love shooting. I love understanding a script and shooting it. So now I'm being exposed to like way more interesting writers and I'm going to meetings where they're like, we have this script. Would you direct this? And I'd be like, yes. And they're like, cool. We hired somebody else, but thank you for, but even that is, you know, it's an exciting experience. So that's where I'm at so far.
Whatever happened to the Singapore project?
I still want to do it. I don't think it's the next one. I think I have a plan for it that I'm slowly percolating. Unfolding. It's so personal. I mean, it has demons and vampires, of course, but it is so it was so based. What's interesting about it was I wrote it when we tried to make Some Kind of Hate. We went to Vancouver. We were sent to Vancouver by investors and we lived there for 3 months and spent our own money casting it and rehearsing it and finding locations. And then the investor said, no, I'm not actually giving you the money. And we drove back to LA from Vancouver in debt. And I was so heartbroken that I wrote a movie about heartbreak that was like based on a breakup that I'd had before. And I was going to, at the time, my producing partner was my wife. She's from Singapore. That's why we went to Singapore and stuff like that. And then we broke up. And then I go and look at the movie and I'm like, this is about an American guy and a Singaporean girl who break up. And I was like, it's weird. I was telling the future. Like a lot of times, like the things that you write turn out to be about the future. Yeah. So I'm even more interested in eventually making that
when it's movie. Right. It'll be when the time is right,
man. Yeah. And I'm not stressed about
you're
that
getting
anymore.
In between. Yeah. You'll be that much better exactly. filmmaker.
Yeah.
That's cool. Yeah. Well, I hope that happens. That sounds exciting. Well, I'm glad we got to do this.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is amazing. Yeah,
Thank you so much for joining us.
This was awesome.
So don't forget Beyond Fest to people that you can still
September
get in.
September
25th. September 25th, 9 p.m. Go to the Egyptian.
He's going to do stand-up for you, give you a free T-shirt.
Absolutely.
And it's going to be a good time. We'll be there. So
Yeah.
Yeah, man.
Excited.
Great.
Yeah, thanks for coming.
Thank you.
All right, see you next week.